It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
Is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's your Tuesday going so far? We'll make it better. That's what we do. And I just got my pump-up speech from producer Jamie Dodd. He said, this is going to be a good show. I can feel it. No pressure whatsoever. Right, Jamie? No pressure whatsoever. You got that gut feeling today.
I got it. Sometimes you know it's going to be a good show.
Scott Hartnell, I'm very interested into what he has to say at the bottom of this hour regarding Cassian and Kachuk, I should say. Scott Hartnell's a guy who mixed it up a little. Scott Hartnell's a guy who probably adhered to the code most of his career. How much of it was violated? What would he have liked to see go down differently? How much of that has to do with officials? How much of that has to do with players? Zach Cassian gets a 2-game suspension. Zero surprise on my part. We talked about this yesterday. Zach Cassian was going to get a suspension that said, we don't like the optics of you swinging at a guy who is down on the ice, despite the fact you think he should have stuck up for himself, but we also want you to play in that game. We know how much attention that draws. Now, we don't want to see anything go completely sideways January 29th in Edmonton, but we want a lot of attention on that game, and with you there, there's more attention in that game. We'll see what it means standings-wise by that point in time. There's some bye weeks coming up here. Edmonton's just got a couple of games this week. Cassian will miss them both. His break extended a little bit. I'm sure he's not exactly thrilled to forfeit over $20,000 by virtue of the 2-game suspension, but he also probably doesn't mind a little extra rest at this time of year. Most players don't. Dylan Larkin, hand up. I'm sure he doesn't mind that extra rest. He doesn't want to be involved in any All-Star festivities. So we'll talk to Scott Hartnell at the bottom of the hour. Rash Madani set to join us in hour number two. And I do want to get to that story in just a minute. Recap of the Pacific Division standings. Nothing changed yesterday. Just so you know, 2 points still separate first from fifth. Calgary couldn't get it done in Montreal. All winning streaks are bound to come to an end. When they end against a team that's going sideways, which Montreal has been doing for a long time, it feels a little worse. Now, I didn't get this tone of complete confidence coming from Flames fans over the course of this 5-game winning streak. In fact, quite the opposite. Fan feedback line, text message, inbox, whatever you hit me up on, most people were saying, hey, I'm not jumping to too many conclusions here. Even though they've won 3 games, 4 games, 5 games in a row, haven't liked every part of the process. Flames just weren't good enough last night, just didn't get to the right areas, didn't make it more difficult enough for Carey Price to get his 31-save shutout in Montreal. This team, surprisingly, given the pedigree of the players that we're talking about, this team has been shut out more than any other in the National Hockey League. 6 times already this season, the Flames have been shut out. They remain atop the Pacific Division, tied with Arizona. Arizona with a chance to jump in front. They play tonight. Vancouver plays tonight in Winnipeg. We'll see what the standings look like when those two teams get ready to meet on Thursday in Vancouver. First of 4 meetings between the Coyotes and Vancouver Canucks. But I want to start with the big story in sports and the big story that broke yesterday during our show. The Astros got caught. They stole signs. They had a system in place. And they got busted yesterday. But not before winning a World Series. Now, the punishment, when it came down and it did break during the course of the show, it looked pretty hefty yesterday for Major League Baseball. And relative to other punishments we have seen doled out by the commissioner's office, this is rather hefty. Year-long suspensions for GM Jeff Luhnow, manager A.J. Hinch down in Houston, a loss of a first and second round draft pick this year and next year, a $5 million fine, which was the maximum they could do in the CBA. I don't care how much money your owner makes. There's no owner that's happy about getting a $5 million fine one day. And Jim Crane certainly was not that down in Houston. Speaking of which, let's have a listen to the aforementioned owner of the Astros.
I have higher standards for the city and the franchise. and I'm going above and beyond MLB's penalty. Today, I have made the decision to dismiss A.J. Hinch and Jeff Luhnow. We need to move forward with a clean slate, and the Astros will become stronger, a stronger organization because of this today. You can be confident that we will always do the right thing.
Why? Why would anyone in his or her right mind believe that? You can be confident we will always do the right thing. The Astros got accused of sign stealing in last year's playoffs, pardon me, the year before, that's 2018, and they said, they went on record saying, we're not stealing signs, actually. We're just conducting surveillance to make sure our opponents aren't stealing signs. Turns out that was a hot load of crap. Maybe they were doing that in addition to stealing signs, but they were stealing signs. The Astros also claimed to be leaders in combating domestic violence. Policy in place, work in the community, pretty widespread campaign. Then they traded for a high-profile player accused of that very offense, and they rationalized it at the time. The Astros then had their assistant GM intimidate reporters. They obviously didn't instruct him to do this, but he did it. Brandon Taubman, who is on the ineligible list right now, by the way. That's the one Pete Rose is on. He's in the ineligible list for a year. I'm not sure he gets a job in baseball for a very long time. If he does, it will be behind the scenes, and it will be very under the radar. Hey, we hired this guy. But he intimidates reporters in a working environment with regards to the player in question that I mentioned, Roberto Osuna. And when confronted, the Astros, as an organization, called the reporter's integrity into question, denied the allegations, and tried to dismiss the claim. Why would anyone believe you are going to do the right thing? All you can do, I suppose, going forward is attempt to convince people of that. But when you have all of this on your resume in recent history, there's a lot of trust to be rebuilt. I'm not an Astros fan. I have no idea exactly how that city feels about its owner, about its organization right now. But if it were my organization, I would not be trusting that it would always do the right thing. Do anything to win? Oh, yeah. I have the belief that my organization is absolutely going to do that. I mean anything. Compromising whatever values we allegedly have? Yeah. I believe that right now. Do the right thing? I'm going to need to see some proof. Here's the real question to you, the baseball fan, the casual sports fan. Does this change your general view of the team's accomplishment? Do you consider the 2017 World Series tarnished? And maybe the 2018 one by virtue of Alex Cora, the guy who got this whole thing together when he was the bench coach, in Houston, and then took it to Boston. At least that's what people believe right now. That investigation is ongoing. Alex Cora has already been mentioned in the commissioner's report, in the investigation, and now they focus on the Red Sox. So perhaps, Washington Nationals aside, two of the last three World Series are tainted or tarnished. As strong as the punishment was, the commissioner's office didn't exactly go Chicago Black Sox here. They didn't say, no, none of you are playing baseball again. You're all kicked out. That's not what they did. And I understand why they did it. Rob Manfred said, I'm not going to levy individual punishment to the players because if I do that, none of them are going to talk. So maybe this is a bad analogy, but if someone gets caught dealing drugs on the street, but they really want the supplier of the drug supply, will you roll over for the guy at the top? Can we get the head of the snake? And that's what the commissioner's office did here in baseball. It feels to me very akin to steroids in baseball. What did the steroid era in baseball really cost anyone? And here's why I think it's akin. Some people think this is worse. Some people don't think it's as bad. Bottom line is this. You can pump yourself full of steroids, HGH, whatever performance enhancer you want. You can know what pitch is coming. You still have to hit it. No one's saying that the Houston Astros players are not talented. No one's saying the guys who hit bomb after bomb when they were on steroids aren't talented. But it calls the integrity of the game into question. But what does it really cost the Astros? What did it cost anyone in the steroid era? No championships were taken away. No records were absolved in the steroid era. Barry Bonds' numbers are still in the books for everybody to see. So are Sammy Sosa's, so are Mark McGwire's. No money was repaid on contracts. There were plenty of players across the league who reaped financial benefit year after year after year. The only thing it really cost was the Hall of Fame reputation of a handful of players. When we boil it down, it's the Sammy Sosas, the Mark McGuires, the Barry Bonds, the Roger Clemens. That's the cost here. The guys who were a tier under that, that we believe were doing steroids. What did it cost Brady Anderson? Now, we can talk about health, and that's an individual cost, but reputation-wise, financially, did it cost him anything? We all know now what he was doing when he was hitting 50 home runs for the Orioles. He made a lot of money off of that. He wasn't going to the Hall of Fame anyway, so what did it really cost him? And this is the question for you, the casual sports fan. How much do you really care? I don't like it at all. I'm a baseball fan. I hate it. I can't stand this. It's bad. There's a certain way to have gamesmanship, and then there is crossing the line, and the Houston Astros hop, skip, and a jump, a long jump, right past that line. Do you look at Houston star players differently? How does that conversation go when the Hall of Fame conversation comes up? Where are you at with that? Now, there's a direct comparable for football right now. I'll give you an example. I've been a coach before, and if you are on the sidelines during a game and the opposing team's offensive or defensive coordinator is signaling in plays, if you, with your eyes, look across the field and during the course of the first quarter or second quarter, third quarter, you can pick up on their system, that is seen as gamesmanship. And that is one of those, okay, we're fine with that. If you can pick up what we're doing, good for you. And vice versa. But you steal our playbook or you get our game sheet, now you've crossed the line. Or in today's modern football, if you were tapping into the radio frequencies of the offensive coordinator calling plays into the huddle to the quarterback, if you had tapped that line and you were now getting those plays, now you've crossed the line. Now you're using technology to the advantage. That's not gamesmanship anymore. That's cheating. I'm not sure there's a direct comparable in hockey. Would you be upset if you found out the Washington Capitals of 2 years ago were all using different kinds of sticks than everybody else that allowed them to shoot the puck 5 miles an hour faster? I'm not sure if you would or wouldn't. There's just no great comparable in hockey. So the question is, as a casual sports fan, as a baseball fan, how much do you care and how much does it change your view of the integrity of the game? That's really the question we're asking you. You can hit me up, test message inbox. You've got it. You've got the fan feedback line. We'll talk about it as the morning continues. Arash Madani is going to join me to answer this question. Did Major League Baseball go far enough? Yes, it's a harsh punishment. Did Major League Baseball go far enough? Hockey last night, not a lot of games. Washington Capitals were involved. Alex Ovechkin gets a couple of goals. Capitals shut out the Hurricanes 2-0. But the deal off the ice, Nick Backstrom. He gets a 5-year deal with the Caps. Anytime you see a player on the other side of 30 sign a deal that has term attached to it, you get a little nervous. You get a little nervous as a sports fan, as a hockey fan. I hear you. But there is a good example for Nick Backstrom. For me, there's a very good template in place here. For a guy who plays a game in a somewhat similar fashion, he didn't have a problem getting it done despite his birth certificate, and that's Joe Thornton. Nick Backstrom is going to turn 33 in the first year of his new deal. Joe Thornton, if you look at his age 33 through 37 years, they were relatively productive. They weren't Joe Thornton of 27, but they weren't that bad. There are guys who can get it done at that age. Nick Backstrom has a game that relies on passing. It's never as though he's been the most swift skater in the league. Nick Backstrom is a cerebral player. Guys like him, you feel better about their opportunity in a 5-year deal in their mid-30s than perhaps other guys who rely on a more physical game or who have been skaters their entire career and you can just see them falling off a cliff. Or maybe they've just barely been able to cross the threshold of skating and you know that it's going to go downhill in a hurry. So Joe Thornton, years 33 to 37, here they are. He played 369 games, and that has less to do with injury and more to do with the fact that one of those was the lockout-shortened season. 313 points in those 369 games. In the 46 playoff games he played, 36 points. So to me, there's your template for Nick Backstrom and why Capitals fans can breathe a little easier despite the, oh, he's going to turn 33 and he signed a 5-year deal. Hey, it might look pear-shaped by the end. It might. But the type of player this is, what he's meant to that organization, the way he plays his game, there's reason to believe he can age gracefully, if you will, at this point of his career. And that leads us to our top five for Tuesday. Let's go.
Counting down the best, the worst, and everything else, it's time for Top 5 Tuesday.
So our top five Tuesday, based on Nick Backstrom signing his contract, is 30-somethings. And we're going to stick with hockey here for 30-somethings. So to qualify for my list today, you have to have completed at least three seasons in your 30s. So I'm going to go with the top five 30-somethings. I'm going to give you a spoiler alert right now. I left Zdeno Chara off the list. He's in his 40s. He's in his 40s. Do you know how many games Chara has played since turning 30? I looked this up this morning. 920 games since turning 30. That is nuts. That is wild to me. So spoiler alert, he's not on the list. Coming in at number five, a guy that a lot of people overlook.
Jammed around the board, Scheifele's on it, bounces it back out to center, race for Wheeler, shorthanded. Wheeler scores!
Blake Wheeler in Winnipeg, number five on my 30-somethings list. Here are the numbers for Blake Wheeler since turning 30. 374 points in 373 games. He's been remarkably productive, certainly with the attention Winnipeg got a couple of years ago. People started to talk about Blake Wheeler more, but he does it a little bit under the radar. It's a game that's based less on what you just heard in terms of goals, more based on assists. He's been excellent for the Winnipeg Jets. I've got him at number five on my 30-somethings list. Number four, the only defenseman to crack it. Brent Burns is on my 30-somethings list. Now, there are holes in his game defensively. We all know that. But the numbers offensively for Brent Burns, they're just too overwhelming for me to ignore. They really are. Brent Burns, since turning 30, 375 games, 333 points. He's a defenseman. That's ridiculous. No D has more points in the last four-plus seasons, and those are the ones where Burns has been 30. No defenseman in the league, regardless of age. I'm not talking 30-something defenseman. I'm talking any defenseman. 333 points in 375 games. And you look at his playoff numbers as well, they're right there. He's played 60 playoff games since turning 30. He has 50 points. So yes, Brent Burns, absolutely on my list. I had a difficult time separating the top three. This guy finishes with the bronze medal on the podium.
The Penguins now looking to shift to offense with Rust. Ryan Rust over to Cahoon. Malkin's got a look here. Fires. He scores! Evgeny Malkin!
Had a down year last year. Admitted to it. Talked about his relationship with Phil Kessel. Talked about how he wasn't good enough. Talked about how last year in Pittsburgh, it's on him. He wasn't good enough. But Evgeny Malkin, since turning 30 years old, has been sensational. And everybody who's watched him this season knows all about it. Pittsburgh, the way they've been able to weather the Crosby-less storm, the Malkin-less storm earlier this season, now the Gensel-less storm, it's incredible. They get Crosby back tonight, by the way. That's a fairly nice addition in advance of the trade deadline. Yeah, we're going to add Sidney Crosby to the list. He's not on this list, by the way, because he hasn't played three full seasons since turning 30. He's younger than Malkin. Here are Malkin's numbers since turning 30. 297 games, 344 points since turning 30. 136 goals mixed in there. And his playoffs, you know about the two cups. He's got those since turning 30. His playoffs, 57 points in 61 games. He is in a conversation with Backstrom as well. One of the lists I considered today was this. Secondary stars. Nick Backstrom has been underappreciated to a certain degree because of his high-profile teammate. Same with Evgeny Malkin. We all think it's insane that he was left off the NHL's top 100. It is a blight on the list. It feels like the list has less integrity without Malkin on there. We all know they screwed that up. People joke that he's 101. Hockey 101. Evgeny Malkin. We know how good he is. He's number three on my list. Coming in at number two, doesn't have the same level of point totals, but anybody who knows this game knows how good he is. It's Patrice Bergeron. Now, this was difficult to put him at number two simply because he hasn't played as many games. He isn't always healthy. So you can debate for yourself whether that means he's aging gracefully or not, but you know how effective this guy is. He's incredible. Since turning 30, 302 points in 326 games. That includes 134 goals. You know what he does in the playoffs. You know how good he is at both ends of the ice. Patrice Bergeron, I've got at number two. He is so respected in the game. He is perennial Selke winner, if not Selke finalist. It's one of those every single year. It's just a fait accompli right now. Okay. Who are the other two guys who are going to be on the list? Patrice Bergeron's going to be up there for the Selke. Who are the other two guys that we're going to put on the list? Unless Bergeron doesn't play enough games this year in our estimation to qualify. I've got him at number two. You want to make an argument? Hit me up on the fan feedback line. Hit me up on the text message inbox. Number one, getting it done again last night. How can you argue with this guy?
A give and go for Ovechkin. He scores! Alex Ovechkin driving to the front of the goal. Vrana switches. Ovechkin fires! He scores! Alex Ovechkin back to back.
Last night passed Timo Salani to move into 11th all-time. It feels like he should be higher on the list than 11th all-time, but he's going to start knocking guys off in relatively short order. He's up to 686 goals now in his career. Next up, to get into the top 10, he'll pass Mario Lemieux. So that will bring some context to the conversation. Guys that are in the near future, guys like Mike Gartner, he's going to pass. Ovechkin's going to continue to move up this list. It's just a matter of how high. But here are Ovechkin's numbers since turning 30. I'm going to start with his playoff numbers where people wanted to knock him forever. Wow, Ovechkin, don't know if he could win. We all know that's a tired, old story. It was tired and old before he actually won, in my opinion, but he finally got it done. Nobody talks about that anymore. Since turning 30, 56 points, 56 games in the playoffs. He's got the cup. He's got himself the Conn Smythe. He's got all of that. 360 points in 371 regular season games. That includes 211 goals since turning 30. I want you to focus on the games there as well. 371 games. He does not miss time. The man does not miss action. Do you know when Alexander Ovechkin misses games? When he's suspended. If he either does something physically that crosses the line or he chooses not to show up at an all-star game. So you're going to have to sit on one side or the other. Technically, it's not a suspension, but you're going to have to miss a game. That's when Alexander Ovechkin misses games. He's been remarkably productive, remarkably durable, all of that, and is one of the greatest goal scorers of all time. In some people's estimation, the greatest goal scorer of all time. Yeah, you're going to land at number one on my list in 30-somethings here on Top 5 Tuesday. You have someone you think I glaringly omitted? Hit me up. You want to argue with my order? Hit me up. We're going to continue this conversation. Get Scott Hartnell's take on Alexander Ovechkin. How ridiculous it is that he's doing what he's doing right now. Also want to hear where he comes out on the Cassian Kachuk melodrama. And for a guy who played in Philadelphia, maybe he had a smile on his face. Those fans appreciated something they saw last night. We'll tell you what it is next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now the arch villain, as you see the shot go in. Brad Marchand must score to keep the game going. Marchand overskates the puck. He touched it, though, with his stick. What's the ruling? The officials get together.
He moved it forward.
If he touched the puck with his stick, that's going to count.
He did move it forward.
What an ending this will be. Flyers are off the bench, but there's been no call made yet. No goal! It's over! Marchand flubs it! And the Flyers win in the shootout! 6-5 is your final! I'm not sure these fans can have any sweeter an ending than that!
Pretty good call. Pretty good call describing how the fans in Philly felt, how fans in most markets would feel if that guy made that play in the shootout. Does it cost his team dearly? This isn't a playoff game. It's nothing like that. I know there's no shootouts in playoff games, but it's Brad Marchand. It's a time where the Bruins were up 5-4 and the Flyers. Flyers came back and scored the tying goal. They get through overtime. They're up in it. And Brad Marchand, the guy who has a chance to win, and he's pretty clutch. Be honest. As much as you dislike Brad Marchand, he is a clutch player. Shows up at big time, scores big goals. So there's probably a lot of Bruins fans watching, Flyers fans watching, thinking, okay, you know Marchand's going to find a way to score here, right? That's just what he does. And then he flubs the puck. He just barely touches it. As Gritty tweeted last night, he just barely licked it there. Underrated story, unpopular opinion. Brad Marchand has changed his stripes considerably in the last couple of years with regards to the extracurricular activity. Every once in a while, there's something that either is a toe across the line or is about his reputation more so than just the actual act itself. But he's not a clean player. We're not going to talk about a Lady Bing for Brad Marchand. He plays the game in a gritty manner. But he has curtailed a lot of the extracurricular stuff since the licking. It's crazy that that's a reference point and that's an actual thing. Hey, since he licked a guy, he's really toned down his act. Likely he never escapes the reputation, but there's a guy who's on the other side of 30 now. He continues to play at an extremely high level. People would cheer for him in this country if he were on Team Canada. They might feel dirty about it, but if it was best on best, it was at the Olympics, it was at a World Cup, and you know Marchand's on that roster and he's scoring big goals for this country, people are going to applaud, and they might feel a little bit dirty. They might feel like they need a shower after it, but they would be just fine with that. He's an incredible player, we all know, and what has the argument been forever? If he would just cut some of that crap out of his game. Well, in Marchand's defense, you don't have to like him. You don't have to absolve him of his sins, but he has cut down on those considerably in the last couple of years. But he flubbed last night. Everybody applauded. Everybody enjoyed seeing the Bruins pick up only 1 point instead of two. I'm Scott Rintoul. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. Get your opinions in. I do want to ask Scott Hartnell in just a couple of minutes' time about what happened with Cassian, what happened with Tkachuk, what should have happened. Did the officials make a mistake? Did he have a problem with either of the hits? It's been a running storyline since Saturday night. You all know that. In fact, I get the text this morning saying that Cassian should not have been suspended at all. Now, it's unsigned. Please sign your text. He got run the first time, run again the second time, says the text. On the first one, Tkachuk leaves his check to target him. Cassian's penalized for instigating. Who was really the instigator? He shows restraint. Happens again with no penalty. Can't blame the guy. If the officials in the league aren't going to protect him, he has to do it himself. They have this one backwards. If I'm Cassian, this happens again. The message has been sent to me now not to stand up for myself. So instead, I'm going to hammer Gaudreau and Monahan every chance I get. Is that what the league wants? I want to deal with the back half of that before we talk to Scott Hartnell. I did say this is a countermeasure. That if you're Zach Cassian and you've been drilled a couple of times, and I will reset from yesterday, I thought the one where he's wrapping the puck around should have been called a penalty. That's my opinion. Apparently there's an angle that shows there's not as much head contact as you think. It looked to me like he got him in the head. I thought that should have been a penalty. You want to call it charging, you want to call it hit to the head, call it what you want. I thought that should have been a penalty, but they didn't call it. And the league has said, we're fine with those hits. We looked at them both. We're not actually going to have a hearing about either of those hits or Matthew Tkachuk. We're good with them. They didn't get called. Cassie wants to stand up for himself. We all know why he snapped, why he did what he did. We all understand it, and we all have the opinion you can't go that far. So he gets 2 games for that. What I did say is, if Matthew Tkachuk continues to throw his weight around, get under the skin of a guy like Zach Cassian, which, when they meet on January 29th, why wouldn't he do that? Of course he would. He's got a player that he goaded into taking a big penalty at a big time of the game, and the Flames won as a result. So why wouldn't Matthew Tkachuk do that? But if Tkachuk isn't going to do what Cassian feels he should in that situation, which is drop the gloves, well, there's your countermeasure, if you want. Okay, we're going to hit your players in a similar fashion. Zach Cassian's not a star player. That's fine. But part of the rationale for Tkachuk not fighting is that he's a star player, Cassian is not. There's a countermeasure here in a game where, as I mentioned yesterday, legal forms of assault are encouraged and allowed. That's part of the physical nature of the sport. We'll see what Scott Hartnell has to say about that. Former Flyer, former Predator, played a lot of years in the league, now an analyst with the NHL Network, and he joins me this morning. Scott, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm great. What's going on in Vancouver?
Well, you know in Vancouver, you know in Calgary, you know in Western Canada, that the talk from Saturday night to now has been about Zach Cassian and Matthew Tkachuk and the melodrama that has unfolded since. Where do you come out on everything that went down Saturday night?
Well, I see both sides of it. For Cassian, it's something that, you know, you got to be aware of where you are, and you know, he did get labeled 3 times. I do think the check is a dirty hit. You look at Steve Downey a few years ago taking off McCammon's head, and he got 20 games, but he was obviously laying out on the ice, concussed, right? So But, you know, as for Cashin's response to go after Tkachuk, you know, Tkachuk plays with an edge, plays on the line, and you know, sometimes you gotta, you know, stand up for what you just did, right? And you know, I know they got a penalty and scored and all that fun stuff, but you know, it's part of the game. It was you know, it was fun to watch the highlights. It was fun to, you know, see the comments after, and you know, it's not that should be in every game, but you know, it just brings that rivalry, you know, back into focus, especially with the standings and all.
And Cassian will be back in that rivalry. The two-game suspension means he's eligible to play against the Flames, which is three games from now for the Edmonton Oilers. Back to the hits. You mentioned that it was dirty. I didn't like the first hit where Cassian's wrapping the puck around from the back of the net. To me, I thought there was head contact. The league said, no, we're fine with that hit. I can live with the second one. I felt that was more shoulder to shoulder, and Cassian can see him coming. Did you have a problem with both hits? Did you have a problem with the first one, not the second? Where do you come out?
They're both all behind the net, but the one that I think it might have been the first one where, you know, it's kind of hard to see where, I guess, he makes contact, but, you know, it's definitely a blindside hit. The guy's head's down, you know, you don't really expect to be hit in that area, and you know, you could look at hits all over the ice. You know, people got Cronwalled by Detroit's defenseman for years, and saw firsthand Jake Voracek get dummied with that one, but obviously he had the puck, he was breaking out of the zone, so it's a little different area. But, you know, obviously I think Cashin should do up his chin strap a little tighter too. He lost his helmet a couple times. But it's hits like that are part of the game. I guess the league didn't, want to take any action against Tkachuk, but, you know, it's probably something that they should look at to eliminate those targeting ones like that, for sure.
You mentioned the rivalry, and I think we've all waited a long time for it to get back to the relevance it seems to have and the gravity it seems to have this season. You played in the Battle of Pennsylvania for a number of years. What was the most intense personal rivalry, Scott, that you had within that rivalry? As far as an individual player?
I don't think any really player liked me, right? I didn't like any one of them. So it wasn't, mano a mano versus, obviously I love getting under Crosby's skin. And, you know, Malkin was fairly easy to agitate and for him to take penalties. And, you know, but that whole kind of dynamic, the, you know, cross-state rivalry, you know, we saw each other in the playoffs a few times. They had our number the first couple years. And in the last few times we met, we kicked their butt, right? So, the one with Brizgalov and all the goals that were scored, they beat us 10-3 in game four to stave off elimination. So it's right through, you know, everything there. It's just, it's exciting. It's exciting to be a part of that rivalry, whether you're, you know, Tkachuk or Cashin or, you know, McDavid and Goudreau, right? It's, you feel that intensity, that drama, the excitement, the, you know, whichever city it's in, you can just feel that buzz for days leading up to that game. And this one coming up in a few games is going to be zero except for that. It's going to be awesome to watch.
NHL Network analyst Scott Hartnell in conversation with us here this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show. Is there any player you played against in that rivalry that either since you've retired or perhaps that player became a teammate, you got to know a little better, you didn't like the guy at the time, and now you have a whole lot more time for?
Max Talbot, he was, an agitator, a guy that, you know, always kind of came up with some big goals. We traded for him, or he signed as a free agent, so it was kind of fun to see him, a goofy guy, a fun-loving guy, and, you know, a guy that, you know, if you didn't play with him, you thought he would, be the biggest donkey in the league, you know, and then he ends up becoming a good friend. So you could say that probably about almost every guy in the NHL that you absolutely despise, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, Cashin hates Tkachuk, but I'm sure if they play with each other, down the road on the same team, they're going to be best buds.
I'm sure guys said that about you, too. Have you ever had a player say that to you, Scott? You know, man, I couldn't stand playing against you, but actually, I got to admit, you're a pretty decent guy.
It does happen, right, where, you know, it's you're kind of a pain in the butt to hit, so you're taking out one of their best players or whatever, and you know, lo and behold, the next year he's a big signing for your team. So it happens both ways, and you're like, man, this Hartnell is a good guy. Man, he's bought me lunch, or he did this or whatever, right? So it's little things go a long way, and I always kind of prided myself on being a just a solid teammate, a good guy, and you know, making sure everyone is welcome.
You played a lot of games against Alexander Ovechkin. We continue to marvel at the goals he piles up, despite the fact he's where he's at on his birth certificate. What to you is the most underrated part of Alexander Ovechkin's greatness that not enough people talk about?
Well, he competes. You know, I think every night, you know, he's played over 1,000 games and 600 and some goals, and you know, the Stanley Cup that he got. He competes every time he's on the ice, and obviously I haven't seen him practice or anything like that, but I'm sure he competes as hard in practicing, scoring goals, you know, trying to embarrass Holtby and all the other backups they've had. So I'm sure that kind of just goes, you know, day to day. It doesn't matter if practice or game, he's giving it all, his all. So his competitiveness, how he, you know, he plays the game the right way, he hits hard, he, you know, he plays defense. You know, like the on their cup run when they won, he bought into the defensive structure. He bought into, you know, how to play the game the right way to win in the playoffs. And his game has evolved so much from, you know, coming in as a dominant, just a one-dimensional shooter, forechecker, forward. And, you know, now he's kind of just completed it, and he's still obviously put the puck in the net, which is fun to watch.
From a physical standpoint, how difficult was he to play against?
Yeah, he was a beast. He always, you know, if you ran him early or, you know, kind of a little whack behind the legs, you had to, you know, keep your head up if you were out on the ice with him later on that period, that game, or even the next game, because he keeps his memory sharp and wanted to get at you. So the guy is just so powerful, and, you know, it's like you wonder how he shoots the puck so hard, you know, how he hits so hard, how he takes the minute and a half, 2 minute shifts on the power play, and then he's out there double shifting to score a goal late if they need one, right? So his just kind of physical prowess out there is unbelievable.
Did you ever try to or actually succeed in blocking one of those howitzers?
Well, I wasn't a penalty killer, so I got out of that mix, which was nice. But you know, I'm sure there was a time or two when you had to kind of, you know, sacrifice the body, and I broke my finger. I don't know if it was him that was shooting it or Carlson. I went down to block a shot and broke my finger, but I couldn't remember who shot it for the Caps.
Former Predator, former Flyer Scott Hartnell joining us here. He's now an analyst with the NHL Network, and he's in conversation with us on the Scott Rintoul Show. So Brad Marchand whiffs in the shootout last night. Philadelphia celebrates. It was pretty funny. Did you have an embarrassing moment that popped to mind for you in the NHL? What was your most embarrassing moment?
Well, a couple come to mind. I only had one shootout, after the overtime, and that was in Pittsburgh. I was like the ninth guy maybe, and, you know, went down and tried to make a D. Puck went off my stick, kind of hit the goalie. And then it was at the Igloo at the old arena in Pittsburgh, and our gate to get off the dressing room was right there. So I skated like three strides right off and was pretty embarrassed about that one. I threw a glove at Ryan Malone on a breakaway in Philadelphia right before overtime, and Marty Baron bailed me out on the breakaway and the penalty shot. So that was a good one as well, just off the top of my head.
After you threw the glove, did you say, what am I doing? Like, I know it's going to be a penalty shot even if I get it.
I didn't know it was a penalty shot, and I was just mad because 20 seconds earlier in that shift, it was a long shift for me, so I was kind of going brain dead. And I dropped my stick, and I went to pick it up. My Malone just put it, like, 4 feet away where I couldn't, like, stop and pick it up because I would have been so tired I wouldn't have been able to get it back to the bench. So I was just on my way to go change, and the next thing you know, he's on a breakaway right in front of me, and I just couldn't catch him. So I just tried everything in my power to stop him, and you know, obviously I didn't think at the time that he was going to get a penalty shot right after. So that was a whoopsie.
Marchand, of course, it's the shootout last night. There does seem to be mounting pressure from fans or those within the game to have more 3-on-3, less shootouts. Some people want 10 minutes of 3-on-3. Other people have said, hey, let's at least go to 7 minutes of 3-on-3 so we can settle more games that way. From a player's point of view, Scott, how much further risk of injury or fatigue that might lead to injury does that present, extending overtime?
No, it's, you know, I watched the Flyers Boston OT yesterday. It was unbelievable. It was back and forth action. Boston had the puck for 2 minutes. Flyers couldn't change. It was awesome. You know, the save at the end of the game, that Halak made on Provorov was ridiculous with, you know, 1 second left. I hit the knob of his stick. So to add 2 more minutes of that, I don't think it hurts anyone. And call it a tie. I'm not sure how that would work out, you know, with points in the standings. You know, it would be, you know, like it was back in the day, you know, when I first started, there was no shootout. So, you know, it worked fine back then. I'm sure it worked fine now if people really feel that strongly about not finishing it with a deciding factor with the shootout.
Do you think most players feel the same way, or do you think there are some that say, hold on here, over 82 games, if we add that many minutes to shootouts, it's already a tough enough schedule. What are you doing to us here physically?
Well, I think 2 minutes on the 5 minutes, there's not many whistles in overtime either, so the game's going to end faster than it is to do the whole shootout thing, and, you know, goes into 7-8 rounds and blah, blah, blah. You're just kind of sitting there. If you're not in the top two lines, you're not shooting, right? So you got your chin strap undone anyway, watching the boys shoot. But, you know, I don't think for wearing down and fatigue factor, it's only, you know, 6, 7, 8 guys that play the 3-on-3 anyway, for, you know, it's the top guys. So it's just those guys that are getting those 2 extra minutes. And why wouldn't they want to play? They have a better chance to score. And, you know, I think players would be for that as well.
Pump up their numbers, helps pump up the contract. Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, yeah. Nothing wrong with that, exactly.
Pacific Division insanity, the collision near the top. 55 points for Arizona and Calgary. Edmonton is fifth in division with 53 points. I like to ask people out of market about this. We talk about it a lot in Western Canada. What sense can you make right now of the top of the Pacific Division?
Well, it's fun, right? It's fun to watch. And, you know, you slide for 3 games and you know, these last 35, 40 games are going to be huge for teams to bear down, to get that extra point, to push it into overtime. You know, that extra point in the shootout overtime is so huge. And, you know, it's fun to have this race, right? And I think anyone in their right mind that thought that, you know, at this point in the season there'd be 5 Pacific teams in the playoffs, you'd be fooling yourself, lying, right? So it's exciting. It's fun to watch. There's so much talent on those teams. Obviously, you know, it's fun watching Edmonton and McDavid and Draisaitl. It's fun to watch the young kids in Vancouver. You know, Vegas, you know, I think will be there in the end, even though they're almost on the outside looking in. So it's a pleasure. It's fun to watch. It's you know, these rivalries are kind of stemming as they're brewing, and it's going to be exciting. You know, last few months of the season.
Of all the teams you mentioned, Vegas to most of us is the most difficult team to make sense of, because we all figured they'd be on top and that they were a clear-cut favorite in this division. I agree with what you said. Hey, when push comes to shove, they're probably going to rise to the top at the end. Why haven't they been able to pull away to this point?
Well, I think some inconsistency. You know, Fleury obviously left the team for a couple weeks there and struggling a little bit. But, you know, basically, you know, for me, watching, you know, bits and pieces of games and highlights, just their top guys need to be top guys every night. And you look at the teams that, like Boston and Washington, those top guys are, you know, on the point sheet every night. They're dominant. They're controlling the games. And, you know, for the Vegas guys, it's you know, kind of hit or miss. And, you know, when you're not, your top guys aren't doing the things they should be doing, they're going to struggle and you're not going to get those points. But it's going to be fun to watch this thing play out. And there's a lot of teams, a lot of fans that are going to be either super excited to get in or, you know, devastated coming down the last week. And they're going to have to run off 2 wins and you know, someone doesn't do it. So it'll be fun to watch these markets and how it all plays out.
Yeah, in a league that trumpets parity, I just have this vision of Gary Bettman looking at the standings each night and just sipping on some scotch. Nice single malt.
I'm sure he's got a projector in his room and watches the NHL Network or CBC, whatever it is. And he's like, man, I'm smart looking at this.
Yeah, it's working out okay for him. Hey, great stuff, Scott. Really appreciate it when you have time to come on this program. Look forward to doing this again in the very near future. Thanks for your time.
Yes, sir. Anytime, man. Appreciate it.
That is Scott Hartnell, former Predator, former Flyer, had a lengthy career in the National Hockey League, talked about that intensity of that Battle of Pennsylvania. You could sense the pride. You really could sense the pride in getting under the likes of Evgeny Malkin's skin or Sidney Crosby's skin. And Scott Hartnell obviously didn't have the top-end skill. He was good. He was better than perhaps people thought he was going to be as far as a scorer. But Scott Hartnell, he liked playing that same Matthew Tkachuk role when those rivalries came around. Let's see if we can get under the top guy's skin. I know Cassian's not that. Tkachuk's not taking runs at McDavid, but you can bet whatever you want. Cassian's going to try to do the exact same thing to Tkachuk the next time around, or he's going to try to do it to Monahan, or he's going to try to do it to Johnny Gaudreau, or someone else on the team is going to feel a little bit of pressure to do the exact same thing. I did like the story about throwing a glove on the breakaway as well. I'm out of ideas here. I'm going to throw a glove. Oh, thanks for bailing me out on the penalty shot, Marty. That's great stuff. Enjoyed the conversation. He's absolutely right about how tense this run is going to be at the top of the Pacific Division, which leads to one question, and maybe you don't want your team to waver, but every team's going to have the conversation. I'll explain what it is, and we'll get into something that can be a little bit misleading. That's next on the Scott Rentoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rentoul Show.
Bring it. Burrow's got time. Launching for the end zone. Jump ball. Touchdown, Terrence Marshall.
Incredible season. Got the triple last night. The triple for Joe Burrow. Undefeated season. National championship. Got the Heisman Award as well. Not a lot of guys have been able to accomplish that feat. Joe Burrow coming to an NFL team near you, especially if your name is the Cincinnati Bengals. That's where everybody is expecting he'll go, as the number one pick in the NFL draft. More on Joe Burrow in just one second. You want to continue to comment on the story over the last 3 days, you can do so as well. That has been Tkachuk. That has been Cassian. Punishment's been levied. Cassian's going to be available for the first game between these two teams since what happened on Saturday night. That game goes January 29th. They play again on February 1st. The schedule sets up very well for eyeballs tuning in right now. Scott Rentoul with you. This is the Scott Rentoul Show. I did get this text, and just before I get to Joe Burrow, the national championship, all of that, I want to get this in. Rob in Calgary says, so what's the argument? The league didn't penalize Tkachuk for a reason. They were clean hits. Why should Tkachuk risk an injury against an angry, much larger player? There's two parts to that, Rob. One, you're right. The league said we're fine with the hits. The refs on hand said we're fine with the hits. I personally don't like the hit, the first one. I don't think that's a hit we want in our game. Now, maybe I'm in the minority. There's a lot of people who play the game as well who feel the exact same way I do. They didn't like that hit. They felt it was predatory in nature. They didn't like it. They felt it was a dirty hit. Now, the league came out publicly and said, we're fine with it. Nothing to look at here. Clean hits. Fair enough. Fair enough. I do want to know what was said behind closed doors, because I get the sense that the officials, in talking to the league or the head of officiating, would have said, guys, we could have made sure that whole thing didn't happen if we call a penalty on that first play. Maybe we'll see the next time these two teams play. Maybe the next time there's a hit, and we don't see every single game, and certainly most games aren't as publicized and as attention-grabbing as the Battle of Alberta. So these things tend to blow up a lot more when they're in high-profile situations. Game happens between the Blue Jackets and Panthers on a Tuesday night, and nobody's watching. People, maybe they see a guy curl up from behind the net, get blown up, and they don't make too much about it. I'm interested to see if that gets called a penalty moving forward. The second part of that, why should Tkachuk risk injury against an angry, much larger player? I agree with that take. He didn't get penalized on the play. The hit that Cassian actually said, okay, I'm done, enough here, throw down the gloves, let's go, I actually don't have as much of a problem with that hit. That hit I can live with. I think it's a sneaky, dirty hit because he's engaged with another player, and as many ex-NHLers have said, you're coming out from behind the net, you have somebody else that you're tied up with, you don't expect someone else to come and drill you. I can live with that hit. I didn't like the first one, I'm okay with the second one. Now, the code, the tradition tells you, oh, you got me with a hit that I'm not okay with, let's go. Tradition tells you you're supposed to throw down. I'm with you. If it's deemed a clean hit, and I felt that one was, I disagree of that being the case in the first one, but if that's a clean hit, okay, you don't have to fight. And in a game where you have so many other ways so many other ways physically to go at the other team. That is the take the number situation. I get it. I also understand why Cassian snapped. But that's my response to you, Rob. Thank you very much for taking the time to send us the text message. You can do so throughout the course of the show. Kyle in Alberta says, if I'm Tkachuk's coach, I love the player that plays on the edge like he does, but I have specifically told him you only fight another player that's of equal skill. It's a trade-off. Cassian has to know Tkachuk's not going to fight him. The penalties he takes there are selfish, cost his team the game. Not much I'm going to disagree with on that take. If I'm Jeff Ward, of course, I love everything about that. And I love the fact that it got my team the win on the power play early in the third period. Continue to send your feedback on that, or perhaps the topic we're going to address right now. I'm not sure if you had the stamina for this last night. I managed to get through this game. I stuck with the National College Football Championship. That was a long game. That's a 4-hour-plus game. It takes too long. I do think they should find a way to speed up the college system, but I digress. They can stop the clock too much, and they drag it out. It's a national championship. You know the commercials are going to be longer, all of that sort of thing. No need to break down the entire game for you. And I know there are some college football fans up here, and people certainly like to talk about it when it relates to the NFL draft. Here's the bottom line. Joe Burrow, LSU, they were just too much for Clemson to contain. Burrow's going to go number one overall. Trevor Lawrence, he's going to go number one in 2021. Just didn't have a great night. He was a little high. He's a little inaccurate. We don't see that. First time he's lost, by the way, since he took the helm at Clemson as a freshman. First time he has lost a game. That team at Clemson had not lost a game since November of 2017. That's how dominant that team has been. LSU, it's a home game basically because it's at the Superdome. That's just where the national championship was scheduled to be played. So it was a very partisan crowd last night. There is no coach in any sport, by the way, that epitomizes his team and his region as much as Ed Orgeron, the head coach of LSU. If you are not familiar, have a listen.
Our great fans for being here. I mean, we left that stadium, the hotel today. What a phenomenal group we had. It just gave us the energy and all night. And they've been with us all year. And give the credit to our players. Those guys fought. We started working last year, January 17th. They worked their tails off with Tommy Moffitt. They did the right things, character, grit, determination. They had their player-only practices this summer. I didn't even know about them, led by these guys on the side. We took it one game at a time. We wanted the team. Got to give the credit to our coaching staff, Jack Marucci, Tommy Moffitt, all the trainers, and just a tremendous night for the LSU Tigers, tremendous night for the Purple and Gold, a tremendous night for the state of Louisiana. We are so proud to represent.
And boy, does his voice represent the state of Louisiana and the Bayou and Cajun and all of that stuff. It honestly sounds, not because you can't understand him, but the drawl sounds like the coach from The Waterboy. Like it epitomizes the region, doesn't it? The guy's been a fantastic leader for them. You get the feeling he lives by the Bayou when you hear him talk, but that's great. The people of the region love him and certainly love him even more now that he's brought a national championship back there. Back to Joe Burrow, the quarterback for LSU. He looks like the real deal. I hope he is the real deal. He seems like a young man who has it together both on the field and off the field. Even when you listen to him speak after winning the national championship, the Heisman, all of it, he hits all the right notes.
You know, my dad won a Grey Cup in Canada, but there was kind of this Burrow curse. My brother lost the national championship. My dad lost a couple of Grey Cups. I lost a state championship. Both my brothers lost state championships. You know, this is kind of our first one, so this is super special.
Got a Grey Cup. His dad, I like that story as well. Us on this side of the border, we like that. Hey, you referenced the Grey Cup. You drop that into your post-game interview on national television. Great stuff. I'm rooting for this kid. I want him to be great. His dad, by the way, played for the Alouettes team that used the staples through the shoes back with Wally Buono in the day when they won a championship in 77. Lost a Grey Cup with Ottawa a couple of times. He was on the wrong side of the Grey Cup. I am all about a guy like Joe Burrow being great in the NFL. I would love it. I hope it happens. More great players at the pro level. Shockingly, I, like you, am in favor of that. But it is also a reminder of this. Dominating in college does not equate to dominating in the pros. Jameis Winston lost one game at Florida State. Can't miss. Can't miss. I'm not sure where you're at on Jameis Winston, but you're probably where everyone else is, in the middle. The highs look pretty high. The lows, oh boy, does he turn the ball over a lot. He threw 33 touchdown passes, and he threw 30 interceptions this year. It's tough to get in the 30-30 club. It really is. Tim Tebow was unstoppable at Florida. A lot of people had questions about his game, whether it would translate to the pro level, but he won so much, and he was so dominant as a runner, and even limited as a passer, he was still dominant. He was still a first-round draft pick in the NFL. Matt Leinart was seen as can't miss when he was quarterbacking at USC. He was a rock star in LA. It's part of the reason he went back to USC. He could have come out, been number one overall in the draft, and he stayed an extra year. Dropped down to number 10, but still, you're getting Matt Leinart at 10 with what he's done for the Trojans. Pete Carroll, hey, this guy is going to be something special. We all know it didn't work out for Leinart. It didn't work out for Tebow. We'll wait and see what it amounts to for Jameis Winston. Maybe he's just going to be a middling quarterback his entire career. A guy who provides a lot of highlights, but provides a lot of lowlights as well. I don't wish that on Joe Burrow. Just like in hockey, for example, I would have preferred to see the likes of Justin Pogge or Ryan Parent, stars at the world junior level, guys who were dominant for Team Canada. I would have loved to have seen those guys be great players in the NHL. My point is, just because you dominate at the college level or just because you dominate at the world junior level doesn't mean it's always going to translate to success at the pro level. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's not always just on the athlete. You get in the wrong situation. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you get in the wrong situation. You got a bad coach at the pro level in football. You got a bad offensive coordinator. You've got dysfunction within the organization. Doesn't matter how good you are. You're not going to be able to overcome that because the spectrum of talent, boy, is it closely congested when you get to the pro level. College, we all know there are plenty of guys who are playing on that national championship team last night at LSU that are never going to play pro football. Never. They're very good players at the college level, and you are surrounded by so much talent that you can be part of a dominant team, but you don't really have pro aspirations. And there are players who, relative to their competition, are deemed liabilities. Hey, let's go pick on that guy. He's just not next level speed. He's just not physical enough. And we have a guy who's going to be playing on Sundays that we can get after him with. We can target here. Just because you play well at that level doesn't mean you're going to play well at the next level. The stupidest thing I saw in the last 24 hours on Twitter, and full credit to Joe Burrow, the season he had, he smashed records this year. That offense was off the charts. They threw touchdowns all over the board. The stupidest thing I saw, somebody on Twitter said, Joe Burrow joins Peyton Manning as the only quarterbacks to have 60 or more touchdown passes in a single season. Burrow at the college level, Manning at the pro level, and this is when we combine their regular season stats with their postseason stats. Are you kidding me? We're going to start comparing OHL stats to what happens in the NHL? Is that a thing? Apples and oranges. How do you even make that comparison? From a Canadian perspective, by the way, Chuba Hubbard staying at Oklahoma State University. If you don't know the name, you better get used to seeing this guy in the limelight. A lot of people felt he should have been a finalist for a Heisman this year. I thought he should have. He led the NCAA in rushing this year. He's from just outside of Edmonton. He's a great story. He's been a fantastic running back. I thought he was going to turn pro. I thought he was going to turn pro because at that position, when you play running back, the odometer's running. There's only so many hits you can take. And I hope he has a lengthy and productive career at the pro level. If it were me, I would have said I declare for the NFL draft. I'm coming to the pros. Maybe I'm not as high a selection if I stay and I win a Heisman as the nation's leading running back next year. Maybe I'm not as high a selection, but I want to get paid for my hits at this point in my career. If I played that position and I were him, I would have absolutely elected to go to the professional ranks. But it's his choice. I'm not going to criticize him for going back. His life, his choice, his decision. I have zero problem with him going back. It's not the decision I would have made, but I'm not going to criticize him for saying, I want to be part of something special here next year. They've got a lot of returners. They think they can win a Big 12 championship next year. Maybe they're in the national championship conversation, puts him on a different level of platform. Good for him. I hope it all works out. I'm cheering for the kid. But it's not the decision I would have made. I would have said, no, you're going to pay me to get hit now. Because we all know the lifespan of a running back, for the most part, we know where it ends. We know how difficult it is to get paid at that position. Anyway, I'm going to take some of mine right now. Hope he has a great year. Hope he wins the Heisman next year. Hope he's the first running back selected in the 2021 draft. I'm not going to criticize his decision to go back. It's just not the one I would have made. He released a video to let everybody know that he was coming back, going back in 2020. There's no great audio from that, Jamie, but there is great audio floating around the sports world. Let's get to what they're saying.
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
It was still a hot topic yesterday. Not surprisingly, it was a hot topic in Edmonton, where I see Flames fans have decided they may purchase a billboard to put Matthew Tkachuk's face on in advance of what happens January 29th. There were some Flames fans who said, you know what Edmonton deserves more of? Matthew Tkachuk. So they're going to see if they can purchase a billboard and put his face on it up in Edmonton. Oilers players not exactly loving that storyline as much. They're not loving the Matthew Tkachuk storyline so much. Here's what James Neal, former Flame in recent vintage, had to say about his former teammate.
The guy's just in a vulnerable position. If it's anyone else, if it's not Cass, and the guy's going down, he's hurt, and I think you can ask any guy in hockey. No one wants to see that hit, and that hit's been gone out of the game for a long time. You've seen guys like Rafi Torres or Steve Downey. Those guys are getting 15-game suspensions and being done in the league for hits like that. So he targets him, he targets his head, he chases him into a battle that he's not in and takes him out. So you know, the whole thing is kind of ridiculous, just the way he talks after and says with the tracks thing is just stupid, and you know, it's tough to see that, and then the way he acts after. So
not surprising to hear that from James Neal, who, by the way, is not exactly a choir boy himself. James Neal's seen a couple of suspensions in his day. He's done some nasty things over the course of his career when it comes to hitting people. You remember? And I know some people were like, oh, good, it happened to him. I was not, even though you may detest this player. Do you remember James Neal getting Brad Marchand when he's down on the ice in the head? Got him with the knee? Just as he's skating by, it's not as though he went full force, but he kneed Brad Marchand in the head as he was down on the ice. So James Neal's done some things in his career that are regrettable actions. At least I would think they're regrettable. So I'm not surprised to hear that coming out of Edmonton. It does help set the stage for January 29th, though, doesn't it? We are all going to be primed. Those clips are going to get replayed. What happens tonight? Do these teams get after it? We're good with it to a point. Elliot Friedman mentioned this yesterday. He was on the station in Vancouver, and he mentioned, look, there's just not a stomach past a line anymore the way there used to be. There really isn't. Our stomach for violence, it's been dialed back. And that's probably a good thing. Some people want more of it. Some people say, I want it the way it used to be. But in general, from a societal standpoint, Elliot's right. Our standard for violence, we've pulled the line back for what we're willing to accept at this point in time. Jeff Ward probably wanted a little more emotion in last night's game. Flames get beat 2-0, can't score a goal. They've been shut out a league-leading 6 times this season. We've all seen the stats that have been rolled out. Eric Francis was at the forefront of this with some of his reporting over the last couple of weeks. Flames are down around teams like Ottawa and Detroit as far as leading in games this year. They just don't lead hockey games very often. That was the case again last night where they lose 2-0. Here's what the head coach had to say.
For sure. I mean, you know, not enough emotional attachment to the game. You know, and this is twice this has happened to us after a big emotional game where we come flat the next game. So, you know, it's the time of the year when we can't do that. We've got to be prepared to play. I thought we weren't. You know, we got out battled, out raced, out competed, out worked. You know, right from the very opening faceoff, and it took us a long time to start to try to claw our way back into the hockey game. But we were flat tonight, and you know, at this time of year, you can't be.
Nope, you can't afford to be, and it cost the Calgary Flames a little bit last night. I've said this before, and this is epitomized by the standings right now. You lose one game, you lose two games, you have a tough week. Just relax a little bit. It's tough to do if you're a Flames fan, an Oilers fan, a Canucks fan, probably a Jets fan right now as well. It's tough to do because the standings are so close. It feels like every point is so important. But chances are, unless you go into a prolonged tailspin, you're going to be able to stick around this conversation. The big games, they're still coming. They're still a couple of months away. I know the 2 points all count the same in the standings. I understand how the math works. But you do have a tendency to build a week up, to build one game up at this point of the season, bigger than it needs to be. You're not going to play yourself out if you have a tough week right now. You have a tough couple of weeks. Now we'll have a conversation. 2 points separate first from fifth in the Pacific Division. Arizona plays tonight. They can maintain the lead in the division. If they don't, Vancouver has an opportunity to leapfrog both Vegas and Arizona if they're able to be victorious in Winnipeg tonight, a team that's in and around that wild card conversation, which Calgary, Vancouver, Edmonton, and the like are talking about as well. Last but certainly not least, this is going to segue us into the conversation we're going to have with Arash Madani. The biggest story in sports in the last 24 hours has been the Houston Astros, the investigation into sign stealing, the conviction, if you will, from Major League Baseball. You're guilty. Here's the punishment. Stephen Brunt was on the morning show with Boomer and the Boys in Calgary today and had this to say.
Jeff Luhnow and everybody else on the baseball side there are, you know, regarded as, you know, unlikable, arrogant. You know, we saw the thing with Brandon Taubman.
Yes.
Over the, you know, during the World Series. Look, no one likes these guys. So the fact that they're getting their comeuppance here, there are a lot of people in baseball are taking great satisfaction that, you know, that the self-proclaimed genius of Jeff Luhnow and his people are taking the hit. It's interesting. And if you look at, read Jeff Luhnow's statement, he basically says, well, yeah, we accept our punishment, but it's all about Alex Cora. You know, it's all about, he makes reference to, you know, I didn't know anything about this. It was all the bench coach. So, you know, Alex Cora is now the field manager of the Boston Red Sox. They won the World Series in 2018. He is implicated in this. He's not going to be managing the Boston Red Sox this year. I can guarantee you that. And, you know, the weight of the commissioner's office is about to fall on that organization. So, you know, that's a, like, this is a bigger deal than, you know, Deflategate or Bountygate or any of the stuff we've dealt with in the NFL. And, you know, if you want to take it to its extreme, you know, it's not going to happen. But, you know, those two World Series victories are tainted.
And I will ask the question again. And while I agree with Stephen Brunt, I will ask this question. How much, as a sports fan, as a baseball fan, do you really care? And what does it really cost the Houston Astros? It's cost a couple of guys their jobs. It's literally cost the organization $5 million and four draft picks, two of them in the first round, two of them in the second round over the next 2 years. So that's the cost. But I'm talking big picture, what's the cost? They're not taking away the championship. And while there will be some around baseball who say, championship's tainted, you guys stole signs, you didn't do it the right way. Does the general audience talk that way? Does it dismiss the championship? Respect is a big part of winning. It really is. You win, you're perceived to have done it the right way, everybody tips their hat. Now, collectively, if everyone says, we don't respect what you did, or not even going to acknowledge you, now it's a different conversation. And now that's where the conversation transitions into what the guys who are at the forefront, at least the poster boys for the steroid era, have dealt with. Yeah, I know you're technically the home run king, and I know they haven't taken away those records, but we don't look at you the same. We don't actually consider you the home run king. That's widespread opinion of a guy like Barry Bonds. But there's a lot of other people who don't get implicated. There isn't a cost for them. Arash Madani will join me next. Did Major League Baseball go far enough? Part of our discussion coming up right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
With what came out in the report, they both had responsibilities, Jeff running the baseball operation and overseeing AJ and all of those people associated with that. And AJ on the bench and was aware, if you read the report, it's pretty clear. AJ didn't endorse it, and neither did Jeff. Neither one of them started this, but neither one of them did anything about it.
Maybe it's the accumulation of things that have happened over the last few years. pretty tough to listen to Jim Crane yesterday tell everybody, well, we're taking action. We're getting rid of these two guys. We have a higher standard here. You can trust whatever we do is going to be the right thing. Rings fairly hollow based on what I've seen over the last 3 years from this organization. It really does. And you're the man who's at the top. And if I am a Houston Astros fan, you know what I want to hear yesterday? I want to hear the buck stops with me. I might not have been in the dugout. I might not have been aware. Bottom line is, I got to be aware about stuff like this. And whether I'm aware or not, I take full responsibility. I take accountability. Now, maybe you see his actions as that. There was some passing of the buck that went down yesterday by the Houston Astros. And if you're just catching up, the Houston Astros, they were fined $5 million. They had their manager and their general manager both suspended for a year. They subsequently fired both of those employees. They'll also forfeit a couple of draft picks in the first and second round in each of the next 2 years. It just rang hollow because another guy who's under investigation, used to be there, Alex Cora, they kind of put a bunch of this on him. Well, he's kind of the ringleader of all of this, and he doesn't really work for us anymore. And Alex Cora, that's the guy you need to talk to. There was a bunch of that coming out yesterday. The only statement I saw that rung of accountability and sincerity was the one from A.J. Hinch. That was the only one. Now, he didn't speak, so sometimes it's difficult to read tone. But I also look at his resume. When what went down with Astros assistant general manager Brendan Taubman during the course of the playoffs, where he shouted the Roberto Osuna stuff at them in the locker room. When that went down, A.J. Hinch was only one of the only guys who said, we don't want a bad working environment. That stuff can't happen. I'm not proud of that whatsoever. That's not where, like, he wasn't a guy who was trying to cover that whole thing up. And there were a bunch of people in that organization. So I lump what he did then in with the statement I see yesterday and go, okay, at least a guy's taking accountability. Hey, man, this might not have been my plan. Bottom line is, I hold an important position in this organization. I'm a decision maker. I'm a power broker here, and this is on my watch. Whether I'm involved with it day in, day out, really doesn't matter because that's my job. So I take the fall here, and that's how it's going to have to be. I didn't feel a lot of accountability from other levels of the Astros organization. Just didn't come across that way. And I asked you last segment, I asked you off the top of the show, how much do you really care as a sports fan? And maybe you're not the biggest baseball fan, but if you found this out about your favorite football team or about a team that your football team lost to, well, it turns out they were tapping into the headset when our offensive coordinator was calling plays to our quarterback. They knew what play was coming every single time. They literally used radio frequency to do that. If you found that out about a team your team had lost to on a playoff run, that it had cost you perhaps a championship. I heard from Yankees fans, Dodgers fans yesterday. Hey, the Dodgers lost a couple of World Series, and they lost to the two teams implicated in this scandal. It's probably a pretty tough pill to swallow. But outside of those places, how much does it matter? I'll give you a couple examples from the hockey world. This was brought up on the morning show in Calgary today, and I thought it was a good example. In Calgary, there are some people, there are Flames fans who will never forget, they will never get over, they will always remember what they believe was the series-winning goal, the cup-clinching goal by Marty Zelina in Game 6 in Calgary. They'll always believe that went in, they'll always feel like they got screwed, but outside of Calgary, how many people talk about that? Not many. They remember the Lightning won the championship, and they might remember that play, but they don't have an emotional attachment to it. So it sort of fades away. In Vancouver, the Stanley Cup in 2011, you bring up the name Aaron Rowan and the suspension attached to it, fans will go on for hours, if you want them to, about how the league screwed the Vancouver Canucks over. But outside of Vancouver, how much attention does that get paid? And that's the question I would ask about this. I'm not telling you it was worth it. I'm not telling you that I'm endorsing what the Houston Astros did. I do wonder how much the general populace cares, or because we live in this age of, okay, what am I mad about now, and there'll be something else tomorrow to be mad about, how quickly do people move on? Arash Madani with Sportsnet obviously covers baseball, covers everything across the scope of sports, and he joins me now for the first time in 2020. Arash, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
Doing great, Scotty. How are you, man?
I'm well. I didn't know if you would agree to do this since I'm a 49ers fan and you're a Vikings guy, but I appreciate you coming on.
Very predictable end on Saturday in Santa Clara, wasn't it?
It was, and you are in a no-win situation, or pardon me, a no-lose situation. Because if your Vikings win, you're happy, but if they lose, you say, ah, Kirk Cousins, I told you he'd never get it done.
Oh, he's just terrible. You know, it's 2 years in Minnesota. Think about it. 2 years ago, the Vikings get to the NFC title game with Case Keenum, and they said, well, Keenum's not going to be good enough. We need to bring somebody else in to get us over the top. And in the two seasons prior to Kirk Cousins arriving, Minnesota went 22-12. And they were 1-1 in the playoffs. And since Cousins' arrival as a starter, he's 19-14 and 1-1 in the playoffs. So they told me there'd be no math, Scotty, but to me that's a regression. And the Vikes haven't been in the NFC title game since Kirk arrived. So we are where we are.
Do you want Teddy Bridgewater back?
I'll take Teddy back. There are a number of quarterbacks I would take it. The issue is it's $30 million guaranteed per year. So the Vikings are stuck with him. They're on the hook for another year of Cousins, who's just not going to win. He's not going to get it done. And that whole narrative of he's silenced all the critics and he's got a playoff win. So, no, I mean, if you're a franchise quarterback, your job is to win a Super Bowl, not to win a wild card game.
And that's the only one he has on his resume so far. Arash Madani with us here in conversation on the Scott Rintoul Show. Let's get to the story I wanted to get your opinion on mostly in this interview. Some strong consequences for the Astros' actions, but did Major League Baseball go far enough?
Yeah, they did. I just don't know what else you can do. I mean, in the constitution of the game, the maximum fine is $5 million, so they got it. They have been stripped of two first-round draft picks, which doesn't sound like a lot now, but believe me, not this year, not next, and probably not the year after, but that is going to cripple that franchise. In large part, not just because of the two first-round picks, but because they were banking on them. They have given away a ton of minor league prospects to bring in Zach Greinke and to trade for Justin Verlander. And then you've effectively fired the GM and the manager. And the GM may end up working in baseball again. The manager probably will. He'll probably be a bench coach eventually. But the message is so strong in my mind because nobody's going to do this again. Nobody's going to risk their career, their reputation, knowing that this is the consequence by doing this kind of activity moving forward. I think Scotty, I know that Adam Silver threw Donald Sterling out of the NBA, the Clippers owner, but Donald Sterling also got $2.2 billion out of it. To me, in my lifetime, this is the strongest punishment I have ever seen from a commissioner in professional sports.
So the counter to that, of course, is that the Astros still have their 2017 title. The Red Sox, we'll see what comes of that investigation, but they've still got their 2018 title. While it has a future cost, it doesn't affect those titles. Was it worth it if you're the Houston Astros?
Huh, good question. Depends who you ask. I think so. I think that's an individual question for everybody. You know, down the line, Jose Altuve, who was part of the 100 lost teams with Houston, what's the value of a championship? That answer to you and to me could be the same, could be different to everybody else. I don't buy into this whole thing that there are asterisks. You know, if we did that, how many asterisks are there beside the banners that are flying at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough? If we're believing in asterisks, each time there's a lockout shortened season, you know, that's the question that comes up. Well, I can't remember the last lockout shortened season in any sport, let alone who the championship winner was. And, you know, when you look at the history books, there's no asterisk there either. So the Astros won. Now, did they cheat? Sure. Are other teams cheating? Absolutely. Was it in that way? banging a garbage can while staring at a live video feed of something else? No, but I will ensure, I will promise you, Scott, that across baseball, are people using foreign substances? Absolutely. Are people doctoring some of their equipment? Without a doubt. Are they doing things outside of the rules of the game? You better believe it. So everyone cheats. It was just the level, the sophistication, and especially that it happened in the aftermath of two memos coming from the commissioner's office outlining to teams, do not use video replay and do not use video machines to do this. That defiance led to this.
Yeah, and that's where I feel like it's akin to steroids, at least in some conversations, where, listen, the guys at the top, that's who you're after, and that's who's going to pay. In this case, it's the Astros organization. It's Luhnow. It's A.J. Hinch. We'll see where his career goes after this. But the players, they're not going to pay, much like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire. Those guys pay with their Hall of Fame candidacy, but you and I both know there's so many other players who benefited financially and with their life, their careers, by participating in the exact same thing. But those people are never held accountable, are they?
Well, the whole thing is this, though. They interviewed, I believe the number was 23 past and present Astros players. And the caveat was, be honest with us. Be honest in this investigation. And you'll have immunity. If you want to get to the bottom of what happened, that's probably what you have to do. Otherwise, what's the interest for a player in cooperating?
No, I totally agree with you. And the analogy I made earlier, and I think, hey, we've all seen the show, is somebody's selling drugs in the street. If you can get them to roll over on the supplier, the head of the snake, well, guess what? You're going to go light on them. You're going to let them skate. And it's kind of the same thing here.
And now the precedent is set. That's the biggest. The punishment is now set. It is the absolute maximum for an organization, for an executive, for the field manager, and there's more to come, Scott. I mean, Alex Cora is not getting away with this. He was the bench coach, which, for those who aren't that familiar with baseball, it's basically the right-hand man to the manager. It's the assistant head coach, if you will. And the Red Sox went on to win the World Series the next year. Was Boston involved in any kind of elaborate scheme? We may find out in the coming weeks and months. So if this is now determined to be the consequence of the action, at your own risk, because, you know, your career could be in jeopardy moving forward.
Who should feel most aggrieved? The Dodgers? The Yankees?
I don't know. I don't know if any of that was happening in the postseason, to be honest with you. I covered both of those World Series. You couldn't hear yourself think. There was no garbage can, being whacked and with 50,000 people going bananas between pitches in October. I have a hard time believing that was continuing in the playoffs. I think this was more a regular season thing, which, you know, led to them having home field advantage. I don't know. I don't know who should be most aggrieved, but I don't think it was. I don't think it was something that affected play in October, but definitely getting there was a big part of it.
Stephen Brunt made the point earlier this morning that this is an organization that already had a bad reputation around baseball. A lot of people within baseball didn't have a lot of good things to say about the Houston Astros. Is that what you found in covering them for the past few years as well?
Oh, the arrogance. The arrogance. Let's remember, when they won the pennant this year, Brandon Tubman, their then assistant general manager, was the one who was yelling at female reporters saying, thank God we signed Osuna. This is an organization led by Jeff Luhnow, the general manager, that dripped arrogance, that refused to admit any wrong. Even when baseball forced the Astros to fire the assistant GM in question, the general manager during the World Series sat at the podium and said how difficult it was for him to do that, and that Brandon Tubman is a good person and a good man, and on it goes. They felt there was an entitlement there, and they felt they were smarter than everybody, and that they were going to do things their way. And their way ended up being not only the wrong way, but just blatant cheating. And I think Hinch will be okay down the road, Scotty, but I wonder what organization would hire Jeff Luhnow moving forward. That's going to be, well, no one's going to hire them in the next year, but that's going to be a real interesting one to watch.
Arash, it's a good reminder, isn't it, of not really knowing the story beyond the surface. The Houston Astros were celebrated from being ahead of the curve on the analytics side of things. They wrote books about how they built the teams they built and the success they had, and they were held up maybe not by people within the game, but by many in the general populace as being the leading organization.
All of that's legit, though. All of that's legit. They still did it. And they lost a lot of games. They drafted well with Bregman and Correa and Springer. But all of that still holds up. Look, you're a football guy, okay? The Patriots, despite their cheating, everything they've done, for the most part, is pretty remarkable from a football standpoint. Yeah, they cheated. They got caught. Same deal with the Astros. Again, everybody in baseball, every organization has at least somebody in there who is breaking the rules. I will promise you that. But it was just the extent to which the Astros did across the line. But I still maintain it doesn't take away from You don't win a World Series, Scott, and you don't get to another one just because you're stealing signals. I think that's important to understand, too.
No, I agree. And that's, again, where I see some sort of parallel between the steroid era and this. Look, I can pump you full of steroids. You can pump me full of steroids. We can't hit it out of the ballpark just because we're not talented enough. And same here. You can tell a guy what pitch is coming. He still has to be able to hit it. It doesn't mean he did everything the right way. He's still got to be able to hit the curveball, doesn't he?
Right. And be prepared and know and the rest. Look, the Astros just took it too far. And they blatantly disregarded memos and warnings from baseball offices. And ultimately it took a couple of one former player and another opponent to go to Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellick of The Athletic and tell them the story. And once that happened, this opened the floodgates. But we'll never know. We'll never know. I covered that 2017 World Series. Houston was the better team.
Arash Madani of Sportsnet joining me here on the Scott Rintoul Show this morning. I do want to talk quickly about tennis before I let you go. It's not top of mind for a lot of people right now, but Bianca Andreescu, she's forced to pull out of the Australian Open as a result of injury. How concerned are you about the extent of her injuries over the past year?
I don't know if concerned is the right word, but I think it's going to be something that's going to continue to come up throughout her career. She plays the game violently. She plays the game hard, on her body. And she's dealing with a knee issue. She's had shoulder problems in the past. I just think this is something that she's going to be dealing with as her career continues. I don't think it's going to be something that's absolutely going to cripple her moving forward, but it wouldn't surprise me if she misses chunks of time throughout the year. I think what's really important in all this is to understand expectations for Andreescu. She had a crazy year last year. You know, she wins Indian Wells, and then, you know, in Miami she had to retire and basically didn't play again until Rogers Cup. And then she's able to win the Rogers Cup in the U.S. Open. The expectations just have to be calmed down a little bit. It is an 11-month-of-the-year sport. She's going to have ups and downs. She's going to win some tournaments. She's going to be banged up. She's going to lose in tournaments. And there's now a total bullseye on her back. Everybody knows who she is. She's not going to catch anybody by surprise again. The expectations for Andreescu are not that she's going to win every tournament. And, you know, if she can stay healthy and put together healthy periods of time, she's going to be one of the top players on tour. She's going to be a top five player. But the most important thing is making sure that body's right. And there's no rush for her at this age to push it right now, especially with a knee.
Well, and hey, I know I'm not going to sit here and say she's one of the Williams sisters, but there was a part of their career that was about load management. It wasn't about playing every single event, and you would think that Bianca, given some of these early injuries, maybe has to adopt some sort of similar philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, she has one round. She won one round at the Australian Open last year, where she really has to now kind of defend her points is Indian Wells in Miami. And then again, you know, she didn't play the clay court season last year. She just showed up to the French for a minute and skipped Wimbledon. So there's a lot more growth left along the way. And, yeah, skipping time is not a bad deal at all, just to make sure you're going to keep that body right long term.
Arash, great stuff as always. I always appreciate the conversation. Feel free to cheer for the 49ers against the Pack this coming weekend. You're not going to cheer
for...
Oh, you
better believe I will.
You're not
I'm a Vikings fan.
Of course, you're not
we
cheering for a
division rival.
We want
nothing to do with that place.
No. No, you don't. You want nothing to do with them. Beautiful stuff. Thank you very much, Arash.
Always good, Scotty.
Really good conversation with Arash Madani, who makes the point, yes, this organization in Houston has been punished extremely harshly. And it's good, and it's going to deter teams from doing something similar moving forward, but it does not take away what happened. You don't put an asterisk beside it. That has long been my approach with Barry Bonds, with Sammy Sosa, with Roger Clemens. If Major League Baseball is not going to vacate their records, and they're still going to be in the books, I, for one, would have them in Cooperstown. I don't like the way they went about it. I don't like rewarding cheating, but if the sport is complicit and the sport wants to benefit, and yet you're only going to hold those of individuals accountable, I have an issue with that. Now, I do believe part of the story should be on your plaque in there, hey, here's what said player was accused of or admitted to or was suspended for, but I see the Hall of Fame as much a celebration of the greats of the game as a history lesson for you to walk through and understand the eras. And if you want to call it the steroid wing, so be it. That's fine. Throw them in there. But we can debate that another day. In Calgary, probably a few more notes to pour over from last night's loss. Hockey Central comes your way next. Plenty of Flames talk coming up. Here in Vancouver, it's game day for the Vancouver Canucks. We'll focus on that next. You'll hear from Elliot Friedman on the Wild Pacific Division and Travis Green, his game day audio. He's chosen his starter. We'll tell you who it is next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw. First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
Elias comes and shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
Game day for the Vancouver Canucks. Possible. First place Vancouver Canucks when we have this conversation tomorrow. That's how tight things are. That's how much tonight's result can change things. Can't change things very much in terms of the points that are going to be allocated tonight, but a win over the Winnipeg Jets and Arizona Coyotes loss this evening. That would be the next team up for the Vancouver Canucks. Coyotes are home to the San Jose Sharks. If those two things happen, we're talking about a Vancouver Canucks team that is in first place as of tomorrow. What does that amount to? Not very much. Not very much right now. It's a nice feather in your cap for a day, and maybe it lasts longer than that, but that's where we're at with the Pacific Division. You'll hear Elliot Friedman weigh in on that, Scott Hartnell as well. The former Predator and Flyer joined me earlier in the program today. We want your commentary. Subway text line 650-650. We promised you Travis Green audio. Who did he decide on as his starter? Well, if you've been on social media, you know the answer to this already. The answer is Jacob Markstrom tonight in Winnipeg. I said I wouldn't be surprised by any goaltending decisions because they've got two very good options. So I'm not surprised that he's gone to Markstrom. It's not the way I would have laid it out. I wanted Demko to play twice on this trip for bigger picture reasons, but Travis Green has his, and that, of course, was the entry point to his pregame press conference today. Why go with Jacob Markstrom after playing him in back-to-back games on the weekend?
Well, I thought he had a light week in Florida, like 4 or 5 days. He played two periods, a couple afternoon games, had a good day rest yesterday, and It's a big game tonight. It should be a competitive game between both teams. We're going with our starter.
Nice to have Brandon back with the group.
Yeah, sure is. Good to see him out there.
Travis, only two losses in your last 11. What do you like from your club coming into Winnipeg? Obviously, it's been a while since we've seen you.
Man, we've won in different ways. We've played some really good games and won. We haven't played well and found a way to win. We've been resilient. We've bounced back when we've lost ugly. And those are all good signs. And we're getting into that part of the year where games are getting a little heavier, a little temperatures rising, and I expect it to be that kind of game tonight.
You mentioned bouncing back, hit a bit of a road bump in Florida. What do you think your team did to snap back so well after that?
Well, we skated. I didn't think we skated that well down in Florida, and the good thing about our group is, good or bad, we can be fairly honest and open with our team and constructive criticism or pat on the backs. We want our guys to be able to accept how they've played, good or bad, and I thought they responded well the two games after that.
Travis, what do you think JT Miller has brought to your group this year?
He's brought a lot. First of all, he's a competitive guy, which as a coach you can't get enough of those kind of players that are aggressive and want to win badly. He's got a lot of skill in his game. He's big. He's aggressive. Can make plays. He's been a good fit on our top line. Like I said, he's matured. Through his time in the league to maybe use some of his frustrations in different ways when he does get frustrated, and that's a good example for some of our young guys.
But the possibility exists if the right results happen tonight, you could leave this building in first place in your division. Does that change the perspective at all for what's possible for this group? Like, there's been so much talk about just climbing above the playoff bar.
It'd be nice. I hope we're saying that for the rest of the year. And I think if you look at the standings, you got five teams that are saying that. And that's the way it's going to probably be. And you hope, our team's going to learn a lot as they go. They have already. It's a young group that's going into some games now that they should be really excited to play in. And the competitive nature of the games are going to rise. And these are exciting times of the year.
Travis Green citing a light week in Florida for Jacob Markstrom as the reason for going with him again today, that he feels fresh. He didn't have to work as long as they thought he was going to down in Tampa Bay. Obviously, Demko comes into that game after Markstrom and the Canucks just aren't good enough at the end of the second period. Demko starts the next game as well. So despite the fact it's back-to-back games, despite the fact it's three games in four nights, Travis Green said, "We are going with our starter in Jacob Markstrom." Not going to criticize the decision right now. I laid this out yesterday. I would have gone with Demko for this game for bigger picture reasons. But if the math adds up at the end of the year and Jacob Markstrom's still fresh and ready to go in late March, it's fine. There are going to be other opportunities to get him in. I do wonder if he plays before the All-Star break. Travis Green mentioned the fact this is a big game tonight. Well, there's a lot of big games down the stretch. Markstrom probably can't play in all of them. Or if he's going to, you're going to have to rest him at some point in time. He does have a break coming up. Now, he does have to participate in the All-Star game. He's excited to do that. That's all well and good. The Canucks have a bye leading up to that. So the final game before that break happens on Saturday. They've got tonight in Winnipeg. They've got Thursday night at home against the Coyotes, which has all of the hallmarks of a Jacob Markstrom starts this game. It's our first of four against the Coyotes. We're in the same division. We're in the running with them right now. Oh, and by the way, this is the team that sunk our season last year. The Canucks weren't good enough overall, but what was the mantra last season? Meaningful games in March. And the reason we didn't get those is because of the Arizona Coyotes. Beat the Canucks twice in a week-long span, and that was it. Air out of the balloon, all she wrote for the Vancouver Canucks. So that has the hallmark of a big game. First game back from a road trip. Is Markstrom going to be fresh and ready to go? Probably. If he's not, is Demko a bad option? No, he's not. And we've seen this recently. In fact, if you go to the Battle of Alberta on the weekend, Mike Smith had been the guy that had gotten the Oilers stabilized again. He was on the road trip, their starter for most of it, got them their wins, but they put Koskinen in. I'm not suggesting Travis Green is going to play that card, but you can slice this a bunch of ways. If you play your backup, your secondary guy, in a game of importance, in January, that's always a card you have to play later. Or you go, well, sure, we didn't get the result we wanted, but we also have our best team available later. And if you win the game, you say, hey, we're confident we can win with anybody. We'll see what he does on Thursday. They'll worry about just trying to get the win tonight in Winnipeg. A victory obviously gives them a winning record on this road trip, gets them back to 500 on the road for the season, and then they come back home with two divisional games, Arizona on Thursday, San Jose Saturday night, and we'll see how he allocates the goaltending in those games, and we'll see if it has anything to do with what happens tonight. It has been a house of horrors. The Canucks have been badly outclassed when they played in Winnipeg. The numbers are fairly brutal. We will talk about them in Canucks Central an hour from now. You want in on this conversation, you've got the Subway text line, 650-650. Travis Green basically alluded to exactly what I've been telling you for quite some time. Be comfortable with being uncomfortable if you are in the Pacific Division. If you are a Canucks fan, you had better get used to that feeling. This is how it's going to be. You're going to have a week like last week where the Canucks lose a couple of games and you think, oh, here we go. I had people texting this show on Friday saying, well, when they lose all five games on this road trip, it doesn't really matter when it comes out, what it comes after that. I don't have to tell you what comes after that. The fact that people were two games into the road trip saying, oh, they're going to lose all five now, that tells you how wild the swings are. They were coming off seven wins in a row. This team has now won 9 of 11, but it sure didn't feel like it on Friday. After getting blitzed in Tampa Bay and outclassed in Florida. Back-to-back wins on the weekend, all of a sudden, not as many people are panicking. I'm not saying that's a vast majority of you. I think there's a lot of reasonable, rational, level-headed fans out there. But you also know how recency bias plays into people's opinion, especially here in 2020. Yeah, what'd you do for me yesterday? We'll see what they do tonight in Winnipeg. As mentioned, this division is going to be wild for the rest of the way. And the math tells you these teams are all going to be in the running unless there are major injuries or an unprecedented swoon for any of these clubs. Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver. I'm interested in something that's going to come out of it in about a month. But before that, let's hear from Elliot Friedman. He was on the program yesterday afternoon, and he was asked about the parity atop the Pacific Division that exists right now.
You know, like, I thought Arizona was home and cooled, and now they've lost their top two goaltenders.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Vegas was a shoe-in, and they can't get it going. And I thought Edmonton would fold a bit, and they're scratching and fighting to stay in it. You know, I think the best team top to bottom is probably Vegas, but they just can't get it going. I think the second-best team top to bottom is probably either Calgary or Arizona, and Calgary's top players aren't playing great, and Arizona's goalies are out. And then I thought it was, you were kind of right at them, and then was Edmonton. But, you know, I think what everybody has to prepare for is it's going to be nuts. You're going to have weeks that you're like sitting there going, oh my God, we stink. We're not going to make it. Trade everybody, fire everybody. And you're going to have weeks where you're like, that's four wins, we're good, we're in, we're okay, and then the next dip is going to come. I mean, all these fans of all these teams, they're going to be biting their nails off by the end of the season because nobody's going to make this easy.
And it's very difficult for people to actually do this, but I'm going to dispense this advice anyway. Try to enjoy it. Try to enjoy the uncomfortable feeling, because when you are uncomfortable, you know what it means? The results matter. That they matter, and it's been a long time since they've mattered in this market, for this team, for this fan base. It's been a long time. What did you care about the last couple of years? You cared about whether or not your guy was going to win the Calder Trophy. That's what you really cared about. Yes, there were secondary stories. And yes, you wanted to see some wins. You didn't want it to be 0-82 unless you were Team Tank, and I think that's a very small minority of the Canucks fan base. But that's what it was about. It was about, hey, can Brock Besser win the Calder? Can Elias Pettersson win the Calder? Quinn Hughes winning the Calder? Where is that on the story rundown this year for you? Where does that rank? You want to see it happen. You want to see him at least make the podium and be one of the three finalists, but that's not priority number one. That's not what you're watching first and foremost. You don't think the Canucks are ready to go. You don't see them as a Stanley Cup contender. They're not a Tier 1 team. But when you exist in Tier 2 in the National Hockey League, and Tier 2, by the way, is capable of beating Tier 1 once you get to the playoffs, but you exist in Tier 2 where you're not a lock. There aren't a lot of teams in Tier 1, but there's some. You know what the teams are. Toronto, Tampa Bay, Washington, St. Louis, Pittsburgh. Those teams are going to the playoffs. You already know that. And there's some teams we thought were Tier 1 teams that might not be. Vegas, I thought, was a Tier 1 team. The want-to-prove-myself-right part of me would like to see Vegas by game 82 prove that right. But they haven't been able to get it together. We're almost 50 games into a season. There's not a lot of teams in Tier 1. So when you exist in Tier 2, it's uncomfortable because the results matter. And you know that a tough couple of weeks can be the difference between finishing 14th overall and finishing 18th overall. And a good couple of weeks can mean you might finish 12th and you might not have to sweat in the final week of the regular season. It's difficult sometimes to enjoy it, but I'm going to tell you to try to. There are some that don't feel this team is ready for the playoffs this year. They don't think in the bigger arc of this organization it's the best thing. They would prefer to see this team miss, get another draft pick, but be close. There are some who feel that way. I guarantee you this, no matter where you fall, even if you think that they're overachieving to a certain degree this year relative to long-term expectation, this team finds a way into the playoffs, and in the second week of April, you will throw all of that out of the window. And you might revert to that at the end of April if the Canucks get blasted in the first round and they're out. But when they're back in the playoffs, if that happens this year, if it happens whenever that is, you will savor that. And the feeling that you used to have will come back. And you'll realize how much you missed it. You really will. And that's what I'm trying to tell you with this uncomfortable feeling you have right now. Try to remember how much you missed that. How much did you miss that as a hockey fan? How much did you miss that as a Canucks fan? You know what sucks? As a sports fan, being irrelevant, having your team out of it. We're going to talk about the Battle of Alberta in a couple minutes' time. People can say, there's always been juice to it. It's not even close. It's not even close to what it feels like right now or what it used to be back in the day, because you have to be relevant for your rivalry to really matter. The games don't just have to be of consequence as far as geography. They have to be of consequence in the standings, playoff positioning, potential series meeting up. Try to enjoy the uncomfortable feeling, because it doesn't come around all the time. Scott Hartnell played a lot of years in the league, joined me on the program earlier today. He's now a network analyst with the NHL Network. And I asked him what sense he makes of the Pacific Division right now.
Well, it's fun, right? It's fun to watch. And, you know, you slide for three games, and you know, these last 35, 40 games are going to be huge for teams to bear down, to get that extra point, to push it into overtime. You know, that extra point in the shootout overtime is so huge. And, you know, it's fun to have this race, right? And I think anyone in their right mind that thought that, you know, at this point in the season there'd be five Pacific teams in the playoffs, you'd be fooling yourself, lying, right? So it's exciting. It's fun to watch. There's so much talent on those teams. Obviously, you know, it's fun watching Edmonton and McDavid and Draisaitl. It's fun to watch the young kids in Vancouver. You know, Vegas, you know, I think we'll be there in the end, even though they're almost on the outside looking in. So it's a pleasure. It's fun to watch. It's you know, these rivalries are kind of stemming as they're brewing, and it's going to be exciting, you know, last few months of the season.
No rivalry with the Winnipeg Jets right now. It's Canadiana. It's a one anthem night, so there's going to be a little extra to it. But this is a team the Canucks are going to be fighting with right now if they can't luck up a top three spot in the Pacific Division. Jets are in and around the same conversation. And I mentioned Winnipeg being a house of horrors for the Canucks. Dan Murphy teed that up with us yesterday as well. Nine straight losses to this team. Canucks have lost nine straight games to the Winnipeg Jets. They've been outscored by a count of 31-10 in those nine games. It's their second longest active losing streak against any franchise in this league. The only team they've lost more consecutive games against does not play in their conference. It's the New Jersey Devils. Sounds weird, but it's true. They've lost 11 straight against New Jersey. They've lost 9 straight against Winnipeg. No better time than right now to get right. The game, obviously, you're going to hear it right here. Pre-game show, your home of the Vancouver Canucks. You'll hear it right here on Sportsnet 650. It is brought to you by NorlandLimited.com. New audio coming in on a topic everybody's been talking about since Saturday. Now that the 2-game suspension has come down, and I do have plenty of your comments, I will read them in a second. Subway text message inbox is filling up. 650-650 if you want in on this conversation. And many of you still do. You still have an opinion on Cassian. You still have an opinion on Matthew Tkachuk. Zach Cassian, first time that he's spoken since the suspension was levied. His next available game, by the way, January 29th, Calgary Flames in Edmonton. Then a few days later, February 1st, they go back to Calgary for another engagement. Here's what Zach Cassian had to say today.
I'm not crying about the hits. It's hockey. It's a game of hockey. It's rough. I thought they're a little bit on the blind side, but at the end of the day, I've laid big hits like that. I've been hit like that. But two times is more than enough. You play with fire, eventually you're going to get burned. And he messed with the wrong guy, and I don't think he realizes that we're in the same division. And have a great memory.
He messed with the wrong guy. I don't think he realizes we're in the same division. I have a great memory. Doesn't sound like Zach Cassian is backing down from any future contact with Matthew Tkachuk. Sounds like Zach Cassian remembers the number, and when they meet on January 29th, those hits might be delivered the opposite way. We're all waiting. We're all tuned in already. If you could fast forward your hockey calendar right now, you would sign up to watch that game tomorrow. Scotty Upshaw, former NHLer, a guy who played the game on the edge a lot of time, bottom six forward for the most part in the National Hockey League, played with grit. He's had a lot to say about this on Twitter. I'm going to read you some of his comments and then ask for your comment. See if you agree with what Scotty Upshaw had to say. Here's what he said. Number one, do I think Matthew Tkachuk should be suspended? No. If that exact hit was against a superstar and the superstar's hurt, then yes. No offense, Cass, but you're not. That's the truth. NHL, you know it. I don't disagree with that. There's no question. And whether I like the hits or not, I do not have a problem with star power getting star treatment. I do think you should treat the stars of your game a little bit differently. That doesn't mean that you can run over a third or fourth line player with impunity and that there is never any consequence, but I think it's heftier if it happens to be a star player. Those are the guys who draw fans to the rink. That's the deal. Number two from Scotty Upshaw. You shatter a guy twice, you have to be ready to protect yourself. Can't hit then hide, especially when it's someone like Cassian. Poke the bear once, shame on you, poke him again. Heads up. Number three from Scotty Upshaw. Love physical rivalries. We have one now, and fans love it. Number four from Scotty Upshaw. League should have let this settle on the ice. No suspensions or fines. Two tough and very valuable players for their respective teams, playing hard and engaging in physical play. Love that game. Both guys weren't hurt. Cassian losing it cost them the game. Enough said. And then he said, hey, I'm going to be off Twitter for a while. I'm going to enjoy myself a glass of red wine in Switzerland. He's playing in Europe right now. So how much of that do you agree with? How much of that do you disagree with? The only thing I will say on the league's side of suspending Zach Cassian, while I agree with the general premise that Scotty Upshaw put forth, hey, nobody was hurt here, and while Cassian lost his cool, that cost his team the game. That's enough of a punishment. The only part I'll disagree with is the optics of what the league is trying to sell. The bigger picture is we can't have a guy doing that because when people see the highlights of this tonight, we don't want them to think this happens all the time in our game, where you have a player who said, no, I'm not willing to engage, and they've got rules, they've got language in there that says, look, if you're the aggressor and this is the situation that takes place, we're going to have to deal with it. I agree with the logical explanation Upshaw rolls out, but the league had to act here because they have rules in place that dictate it. This isn't the unwritten code. This isn't, hey, we know the way it's supposed to go. This is actual language in your rule book. So I completely understand why the league came down on Zach Cassian the way it did. And I also understand why they limited it to 2 games. I told you that yesterday. When the suspension comes down, it will not be longer than 2 games. They want Zach Kastner to be a part of this as much as he wants to be a part of it, as much as Oilers fans want him to be a part of it. Ryan in Calgary sent this in to the Subway text line here today. Cassian Tkachuk, I blame McDavid for the Cassian suspension. And he says, stick with me. This is a new theory. I've never seen this before. He called for heads up and saw the hit coming. Then he arrives and gives Tkachuk a loving push. If McDavid ties Tkachuk up, drops the gloves, doesn't need to throw bombs, but shows up and engages in a fight, Tkachuk fights him. Oilers team rallies behind their captain more. Cassian's not suspended. They don't get a four-minute PK and lose the game. That is a wild theory. That is a wild theory. I understand what you're saying, Ryan. I just happen to disagree with it. The only reason I want Connor McDavid dropping his gloves is in overtime celebration a la Sidney Crosby in a gold medal game or a playoff clinching win. That's the only time I want him dropping his gloves, throwing them up to the heavens. I don't even want him taking them off, grabbing the other guy by a sweater and saying, hey, we're not really going to fight, but I'm going to make it look like we're going to fight. I don't even want to see that. Those hands are too valuable. That player is too valuable. I want nothing to do with that. Bean in Delta says, everyone keeps saying Tkachuk shouldn't have fought Cassian because he's a different weight class. Tkachuk 6'2", 202. Cassian 6'3", 211. Not a huge difference. No, people aren't saying that he shouldn't fight Cassian because they're a different weight class. Tkachuk's a fairly big boy. They're a different fight class. And they are also a different level of offensive player. And there are very few guys, and you can be, hey, I don't like guys picking their spots. You can totally be on that side of this argument and criticize Matthew Tkachuk for it because there are very few guys that are in his category. There are very few guys who play the game as physically as he does but are as talented offensively as he is. You have a hard time figuring that out in the league. If Brendan Gallagher was involved here, okay. We got a 30-goal scorer. We got a 30-goal scorer. Okay. And Gallagher's hefty. He's a fire hydrant. He's not as big as Tkachuk. Tkachuk, in that case, may have engaged. I'm not sure. Cassian's a more skilled fighter. Tkachuk, you can call it an excuse if you want. He can say, hey, that's not a fair trade. If we go to the penalty box, that's not a fair trade. My team is in the deficit now. And that has been his rationalization, more so than Zach Kastner weighs a lot more than me and he's a lot taller than me. Colin from Langley, get one more comment in before we get to Dieter Kurtenbach on the other side. I miss Cass. Love his response. The final hit was okay, but the hit-to-head before wasn't. Hockey players have long memories, as Kastner pointed out today. No one cried foul when someone dropped the gloves and went after Matt Cook. Number 19, as in Tkachuk, is going to have to face the music from time to time. That is Colin in Langley. What's been the most impressive part about where they have arrived? I'll tell you which team I'm talking about when I speak with Dieter Kurtenbach next, right here on your home of Canucks hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Half the distance to the goal, Rivers throwing this side of the field to the end zone, touchdown, Gates. Career touchdown catch number 111, which ties him with Tony Gonzalez for the most by a tight end all time.
That's it. He's done. Probably, we think. We've heard this from Antonio Gates before, but I think after 16 years, Antonio Gates has officially hung him up. Would he consider coming back if Tom Brady gave him a call? Me wonders. I wonder. Scott Rintoul with you. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. Canucks Central comes your way at the top of the hour. Bick Nazar and I in studio. Greg Wyshynski will join me. We're going to talk a little football here in just a matter of moments. Maybe sneak a little baseball talk in there as well with Dieter Kurtenbach, Bay Area News Group, writes for the San Jose Mercury News. Always an excellent interview. Yes, Antonio Gates is done, but one of my favorite things of yesterday, time passes, so it's so passe now. Pro Football Focus, I believe it was, put out this little game, if you will. You know, sometimes you go to the lottery simulator. All right, which team's going to come up with the first draft pick in the NHL this year? Fans in Vancouver are well immersed with the lottery simulator over the last few seasons. But I digress. Pro Football Focus put one up that was Tom Brady, and it was the jersey on Tom Brady flipping every single, sixth of a second, 0.2 of a second, and it was Raiders, it was Chargers, it was Patriots, it was Colts. And basically, every time you clicked on the GIF, it would stop on a particular jersey. And that was the game. It was kind of like the lottery simulator. Hey, every time you click, it'll tell you where Tom Brady is playing next year. Chargers are interesting. I still think that he goes back to the Patriots. I think that is the odds-on favorite. I think the relationship with Mr. Kraft, as he calls him, with Robert Kraft, I think ultimately that wins out, unless that relationship between he and Belichick is so fractured that Brady says, you know what, screw you. You've gotten too much credit for my accomplishments. I'm going to show you that I can do it, and I'm going to go somewhere where they'll appreciate me more than you do. Or at least they'll give me a better offensive line and a couple more weapons than we had this season. He's going to get to keep Josh McDaniels. He didn't get the job in Cleveland. I think that also leads to Tom Brady coming back. But it is interesting to think about. I think it's the biggest story of the offseason simply because of his legacy and what it might mean if he's not in New England. Again, I still think that's where he ends up. I think he remains there. I think he's a career Patriot when all is said and done. But he wouldn't be the first and he won't be the last guy to spend almost all of his career fashioning a Hall of Fame career with one franchise and then sent head somewhere else. We all know Emmitt Smith. We all know Jerry Rice, and he went to three other teams. There's so many of them, so many players. And hey, if you're of the opinion, play as long as you can, that's fine. We all like the Sedin story, but most guys don't get to do that. Most guys don't get to spend their career with one organization. If Tom Brady goes, what does it look like in L.A. with the Chargers, the Colts with that offensive line and Frank Reich calling plays? I think that personally would be the weirdest look. Just that jersey on Tom Brady after all of those years of rivalry with Peyton Manning, that to me would be the weirdest look. Chargers, yeah, it's still in the AFC, and the Chargers don't really have a feel to them, though. The feel is failure, I suppose, in a variety of capacities. Sad but true. I mean, that is kind of the reputation of the former San Diego, now LA Chargers. How's it going to end this year? Brady would certainly change that reputation, at least for the time being, if he landed there. Oakland would also be weird. I understand why they'd want him. I understand how they'd want to sell tickets. Not that there's going to be a problem in Vegas. I still think he winds up with the Patriots. Let's talk a little football. A guy who's going to be covering some this coming weekend and perhaps beyond, Dieter Kurkenbach of the Bay Area News Group, joining me here to talk a little San Francisco 49ers, a little NFL football. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing very well. What is the temperature in San Francisco right now as that city awaits its first NFC championship game in a while?
About 56 degrees now. people are excited. I mean, it's hard to get us West Coasters up for a big game. It's not a region of the country, and this certainly being sort of a key city on the West Coast, it's not an area that's just going to get up for anything. They're not going to show up for the sake of showing up. They wouldn't support a bad team, as we've seen over the last couple of years with the 49ers. But after that win against the Vikings, it's impossible not to see red everywhere. It is impressive. This is one of the larger fan bases in the NFL. It spans far further than just, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area. And, man, I mean, it is fully actualized at this juncture. It'll be a hell of a showdown because we know the Packers can bring it, too.
Yeah, they can. They've got some guy named Aaron Rodgers. More on that in a second. I know at the beginning of the year, the expectation was, hey, just get back to relevance. And then that changed to, hey, what might this be? Could this be a playoff team? If you told 49ers fans halfway through the season, you're going to get to the NFC Championship game, they would have signed in a heartbeat. They would have said, that's gravy, even if we lose there. When did the expectation change from that to, you know what, why not us?
Well, I think it changed even before halfway through the season. You have to remember, halfway through the year, they were 8-0, and it was against a weak schedule, to be fair. But 8-0 is 8-0 in the NFL. You know how hard it is to just win games in that league, and certainly 49ers fans knew that from how few wins they had had over the last couple of years. So I don't know if everyone was thinking Super Bowl or bust at that juncture, but after the first, I would say, three or four games of the year, when it was evident that this defense, even though, again, was going against weak offenses, was kind of something else, that it was significantly better than was expected, and that this defensive line could wreak havoc on anybody, that's when people started to get amped, because you know Kyle Shanahan is going to put points on the board no matter who is his quarterback, no matter who the skill position players are. Kyle Shanahan's going to score points. And if this defense could even be halfway decent, and that's kind of what it was towards the tail end of the year when they had some key injuries, if it was even halfway decent, they were going to contend. And now that the defense is back to as fully healthy as you could possibly be at this juncture, has all of its key players back, we're back to Super Bowl expectations.
As far as individual impact is concerned, which player has changed the equation most for the 49ers between these two guys, Nick Bosa on the defensive side or Emmanuel Sanders' addition to that offense?
I don't want to beseech Emmanuel Sanders. He's been fantastic. But, man, I mean, what Nick Bosa has done is truly remarkable. People do forget this team's in the NFC Championship game. That's not a wild surprise. You could have gotten pretty good odds on it in Vegas, but people expected this team to be halfway decent. They were a 9-7 sort of team, 8-8 sort of team, and you never know how the ball bounces. But this, Nick Bosa was selected second overall last year, and the 49ers didn't trade up to get him. And he talks all the time that he came into a winning culture. That was news to me. I mean, I know that the culture was really solid and all that, but he came to a winning team. No. They stunk. That's how they got him. And he was second in the NFL in pressures this year behind, you know, some elite players. I just can't say enough about what he's done. He looks like a 10-year pro with the 21-year-old body. That's the best kind of rookie you can have. And the 49ers' pass rush remained really relevant, even with Dee Ford, their big offseason signing trade out, because Nick Bosa just remained dominant. And I think he won Rookie of the Year today. That is an easy award to give him. He has been absolutely fantastic. Emmanuel Sanders has been good, but he's not really the number one on this team. Deebo Samuel's really come on as of late. Nick Bosa, from start to finish, has been the best player on this defense.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And the only reason I nominate Sanders is that he allows everything to slot properly, it feels like, on that offense. His addition means defenses have to pay attention to him. If not, he will kill you like he did against the Saints. It means a little less attention for Kittle. And Deebo Samuel, to me, has been the biggest beneficiary of Emmanuel Sanders being added to this offense.
No question. I mean, you think about where the 49ers were at about halfway through the year. They didn't know who their top three wide receivers were, and they've really locked them in. They run a lot of 21 personnel, which means two wide receivers. But, man, when they do have all three on the field, it's a hell of a combo. And Kendrick Bourne, who caught the first touchdown pass on Saturday, has been a real solid player as of late. And that's not something many people expected. He was kind of a hot and cold kind of guy. But he has been absolutely fantastic, especially on third down. And we all know that's the down where you win playoff games. The 49ers really have continuity at the wide receiver position now. And you're 100% right. That's probably not possible unless Sanders comes in that trade.
Will this feel like a failure if this team does not advance to the Super Bowl?
Yes, because they're 7.5-point favorites over a team they absolutely whooped not more than 2 months ago. I mean, yes, it would be. Now, if you were to take the bird's eye view and look at it and you go, well, that's ridiculous. No one expected anything out of the 49ers. Well, things change. Expectations change. And the expectation of this team when the playoffs started, before their first playoff game started, because when the Saints were in it, that was a worthy adversary. But you look at in that game against the Vikings, I thought I was taking crazy pills. In fact, I was telling everybody, get double-digit lines if you can. Money is available for you for free. And sure enough, that's what happened. And I think we're going the same way again. The Packers are a good team. If they're the second-best team in the NFC, then the 49ers have a massive gap between them. And I think it should be another double-digit victory. And when that's the case, you just can't say that it would be acceptable to lose such a game.
Dieter Kurtenbach, the Bay Area News Group, my guest this morning here on Sportsnet 650. Is there a comparable in that sense to 2011? That team at the outset of the year wasn't supposed to get to the NFC Championship game, lost a heartbreaker to the New York Giants, who went on to win the Super Bowl. But it was the opening of a window for the franchise. Mm. Is there a comparable to that?
Yeah, I think, listen, they have a lot of guys that need to get paid at the end of the year, but I don't see this as a Rams-like run. Garoppolo is reasonably paid. His contract is well on the books. They've already paid him the majority of the money on it, it seems as if, given the cap hits early on. They have to pay Kittle. They have to pay DeForest Buckner, who was massive against the Vikings and has been really good all year. There are guys who are going to need to get paid. But the 49ers handled the salary cap as shrewdly, and this has been a negative on them in past years, as shrewdly as any team in the NFL. I imagine that they're going to be just fine in manipulating all of it and keeping everybody around. I'm certain that people will want to come out here and play in Kyle Shanahan's system, play with Robert Saleh, who didn't get that Browns job, and that was a big boost to the 49ers. I just can't see this team being irrelevant again anytime soon. They have been on the right track for the last couple of years. They had some bad luck, but when you have an offensive play caller as elite as Kyle Shanahan, and you have key players, I mean, you have the best tight end in football, you have probably the best defensive line in football, you have a damn good quarterback, I'm not really sure what else you need on top of just they always seem to find a guy or two.
It always trickles down in organizations, and for years the owner of the San Francisco 49ers was criticized, and deservedly so, for his behavior. What is the lesson from the way Jed York has conducted himself over the last number of years that perhaps other organizations should emulate?
Shut up and sign the checks. He empowered – listen, this could have gone very wrong. He had to take a leap of faith. He didn't really have much of a choice but to take a leap of faith when it came to giving – Kyle Shanahan a six-year contract, letting Shanahan pick his own GM, basically handing over his entire football team to a guy who had never been a head coach before, and a guy who was coming off of that Super Bowl debacle. We've seen with the Bears, I mean, one bad instance can really mess up your mojo for life. So it was bold, but he needed to shut up and sign the checks. He overmeddled, and then he finally said, okay, I see it. I overmeddled. I'm now going to step 100% out of the way. It turned out to be the right call. I don't know if there's really a lesson. It's everything's on a case-by-case basis, but you look at teams like the Browns, who consistently have an owner meddling, overthinking things, pretending as if they know best. I know they have the money, but it's a different industry. It is an interesting analog. Ultimately, ownership is the great equalizer in all of sports. The teams that stay bad, because they have a bad owner, and Jed York could have probably been put in that camp, but I mean, he got Jim Harbaugh, and he got Kyle Shanahan. Those are two pretty good wins.
How excited are they within the walls of that organization that the Cleveland Browns decided to go with Kevin Stefanski instead of Robert Saleh, who will now remain the defensive coordinator in San Francisco?
They're a bit conflicted because they know that Robert deserved that job. I'll say this. I have been a Robert Saleh defender for a couple of years now. There are a lot of people who wanted his head after last year. And I think fairly so. The defense had been really abysmal for 2 years, and he hadn't shown the pragmatism necessary to keep himself off a hot seat. But he is just such an impressive man. I know that seems like a ridiculous reason to be kind of someone's advocate, but you just can't help but believe in the guy. He's an offensive-minded defensive coordinator. Kyle Shanahan is an offensive coordinator that attacks defenses because he has a keen understanding of everybody's rules on the defense. This team is full of polymaths. He is as sharp and organized a guy as there is in the NFL. He's a tremendous leader of men. It was a mistake for the Browns not to hire him, I think, long term. Though I do think that Robert Saleh won't regret not going to the Browns. So the 49ers are ecstatic that they were able to keep somebody who has been so critical to their success this year, but also kind of angry because even when a coach does leave, that is somewhat of a statement on how well you played this year. So they feel a little disrespected in a weird way.
Turn our attention to baseball. I imagine this is a big talking point in the Bay Area today, what's going on with the Houston Astros. What's the view from a city where, hey, they put up three championships in a few years and obviously has a much different reputation around the San Francisco Giants than around the Houston Astros these days?
I think the more of the conversation exists on the other side of the Bay, and if the Oakland A's knew anything about marketing and trolling, they would put up some banners for the next two, you know, the 2017 and 2018 AL West Championship banners at the Coliseum on opening day. I think that's the fan base that's most livid about it. I think that anyone who's casting stones towards the Astros, and listen, we'll get our jokes in, don't get me wrong, save for the Red Sox, but anyone who's casting stones towards the Red Sox and Astros, they probably want to be careful. This is way more widespread than most people think.
Yeah, it certainly is. And we had a guest on earlier today who made the point, look, everybody's cheating. It's just to what degree. What's the feeling you get from the Houston Astros and just the reputation they've had in the last number of years that has ultimately culminated in this?
They're brazen and they think they're smarter than everybody else, and they've won a couple of World Series, and that's only emboldened them further. And so it's nice to see bad people's a very strong word, but rude people get their comeuppance. I had no problem with in fact, I'm a big fan of the way they built their baseball team, but they're no holds bars, anything goes. We're the smartest people and everyone else is a moron model. It just rubbed me the wrong way on a personal level, and I'm sure it rubbed a lot of people around baseball the wrong way. But again, the signs are there. They're available for anybody. There are advanced scouts in the NBA who know and write down every single play call signal. We kind of just did this with the Patriots thing. Like, if it's on a field of play, I almost think it's fair game. Just don't be so, I don't know what your rules for broadcasting up there are, but don't be so brazen about it is probably the nicest way I can put it. Don't be so aggressive and don't play the, oh, woe is me, everybody's doing it card. Had the Astros maybe been a little bit nicer, had the Astros handled their business a little cleaner, they probably wouldn't be in this situation. But the way that they are and having success, everyone's going to come for you, so they're the first domino to fall.
Dieter, always enjoy the conversation. Thank you very much for taking the time again today. Hope we're talking about a Super Bowl appearance here in a couple of weeks.
It'll be fascinating. Looking forward to it. Thanks.
That's Dieter Kurtenbach, Bay Area News Group, talking mainly about the San Francisco 49ers, top seed in the NFC. They do have a big spread that they need to cover if you're so interested in such things, but and a heavy favorite. A heavy favorite against the Green Bay Packers. There should be some trepidation, I will throw out there. And those of you who listen to this show know that that's the team I cheer for. It's the team I follow most closely, and it's the team I can be most critical of, and an organization I've been very critical of in the past for the way they've handled their situation. There's something about seeing a team a second time. Look, on paper, this matchup favors San Francisco, and we'll talk more about it as the week goes on. What gives Green Bay problems? Teams that can run the ball and can pick on their linebackers a little bit. As well as Russell Wilson did against the Packers passing the football in the second half of the game, that's actually their strength. That's generally the strength of the team. But usually they're a little better at containing the guy throwing the rock. And Russell Wilson was able to move around. Anytime you're able to extend plays, guys come open. It's tough to cover for that amount of time. And Wilson beat them to a certain extent with his legs as well. The Niners can run the ball. They have one of the best rush offenses. They arguably have the most diverse running game in the National Football League this year. You just don't know which guy's going to get you and how they're going to get you. Kyle Shanahan, honestly, I think he gets his kicks out of designing run plays. It's Kyle Shanahan's run clinic. That's what it is basically every single Sunday. He's that good at designing it. And then defensively, what are you scared of the most? Well, you're scared of Aaron Rodgers, and what has made the 49ers into what appears to be a championship-level defense, then get after you with four guys. They don't have to bring extra help most of the time. They can. They'll blitz every once in a while. But the four guys who happen to be in, they'll rotate on that D-line. They got Nick Bosa. They've got Dee Ford. They've got Buckner. They've got Armstead. They'll come after you. And if they can get to you and they can keep seven guys in coverage all the time, it's tough to beat them. So on paper, this matches up well. But I'm going to give you a statistic. And you might not even need that. Maybe all you need to think about is Aaron Rodgers and the way he's capable of dominating a game. This meeting between the Packers and 49ers, it's the 37th time in the Super Bowl era that teams in the playoffs are going to meet after one of the teams beat the other teams by 25 or more points. Niners whooped the Packers earlier this year, 37-9. It's the 37th time that in the first 36 meetings, it's not even close to as overwhelming as you would think it is in the, when the playoff rematch comes around. 22-14. So the victor still has the edge. It's an 8-game spread, but it's not a big one. 25 points is a lot. Tough to beat teams by 25 points. Now, in conference title games, it's a lot better. 7-2. That favors the San Francisco 49ers. But don't go counting out Aaron Rodgers. Not yet. Not coming back to the Bay. Not with a chance at revenge. I will say this, however, and I know there's not a lot of Packers fans here. There's not a lot of Niners fans either. I don't know who Seahawks fans would actually be rooting for in this game. Jamie, you tell me. You're a Seahawks fan. You don't like the Packers because of playoff matchups in the past and because things have been rough anytime they've gone to Lambeau. You don't like the 49ers because they're a division rival and just beat your team in Week 17. Who would you actually throw your support behind this
week? So here, I'll say I'm not sure I'm qualified to represent the 12s on this matter because I'm not a hardcore Seahawks fan. I'm just a Seahawks fan by virtue of, hey, I grew up in Vancouver. They're the closest team. If they win, that's nice.
You're not like Bick.
So I'm not Bick. So you're going to have to ask Bick maybe to get the official Seahawks fan response here. I'll say from my point of view, I'm rooting for the Niners because I want to see the best possible game in the Super Bowl. And to me, that's Niners-Chiefs. That's what I want to see, so I want the Niners to win. It's not a pro or con Green Bay thing or pro or con San Francisco thing. I just want to see the best game.
Welcome aboard, Jamie. Welcome aboard. We will see you this weekend when the Niners host the Packers, late game of the two conference championships that go on Sunday. By the way, that last stat, 7-2 in conference title games, teams that beat their playoff opponents by 25 or more points during the regular season. That's in the Super Bowl era. That number obviously favors the San Francisco 49ers as well. We'll certainly tee up that game for you on our six-pack for the weekend. Comes to you every single Friday on the Scott Rintoul Show. It's brought to you by Neutral Vodka Soda. Coming up next, it's Canucks Central. Game day in Winnipeg. Can they bump the slump? 9 consecutive losses against the Winnipeg Jets. Jacob Markstrom gets the start. More on that next with Scott Rintoul, Bick Nizar, and Greg Wyshynski of ESPN right here on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.